Hello, and welcome to episode 155 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, a place where small press comics make one hell of a big noise. I'm your host, Vince Hunt, creator of The Red Mask from Mars, and joining me this week are the creator of the webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
And who's calling in from a van today.
He just like shouted it over the top of a wall at us for a laugh.
Yes, so just imagine that for the whole show. Dan is behind a wall and will pop up now and then just to speak to us. And the other voice you can
it's
hear...
It's like that neighbour in Home Improvement.
Yeah, he totally is.
Yeah.
It's neighbour Dan. We need some fan art of that. And also, the other voice you can hear is the man whose mutant power is being too damn sexy. It's Tony true. Esmond.
Yeah, too sexy. Well, not sexy at all. Opinion.
Yeah. Let us know your thoughts on
a level between 1 and 93 of my sexiness.
Oh, yeah. Why 93? Why 93?
No, I don't like 100. That's weird, isn't it? Everyone needs to go 100, won't they?
Yeah. You don't play by the same book of rules that everyone else does, do you?
I live in a world of rules.
Yeah. What are rules, hey? Dan, can you hear us over the other side of the fence?
Yes, I can hear you. Yeah.
Who needs a safe word? Dan's got a safe word, haven't you, Dan? What's your safe word?
What's your,
I've forgotten it, so my wife's just been giving me abuse for these past 10 years. I don't know how to stop it.
Yeah. Oh, dear. It's already started off well. And what a show we have for you this week. It's going to be a cracker. Do you know what else is a cracker?
Oh, no.
Christmas. God. No, it is, of course, Comic House, the wonderful folks.
Yes.
ComicHouse.com, the place there that you can go to for all your independent comics. I almost completely messed that up then already. But what would a sponsorship ad be if we didn't absolutely make a mess of it? Yes, Comic House helps sponsor the show, keep us running free every week. And also, they've got loads of great independent comic books out there that you can get hold of. If you go to the web house...
Yeah, the web house. The Netflix for comics.
I've just been too chilled out this week. That's what it is. I just need to get back in the game. Yeah, but the Netflix for comics is Comic House, the app as well. So if you like to read your indie comics digitally, then you can go to comichouse.com and then find out more about the app. And there's stuff being added all the time, but they've got a massive selection of stuff. And what's on there at the moment, lads?
Oh, there's Captain Cosmic. We mentioned that.
The great Captain Cosmic. Yeah.
I
can't. I can't wait for issue two of Captain Cosmic.
Oh, yeah, he started it, isn't he?
Yeah,
he has.
Yeah.
There's the book I mentioned last week, The Shadow of a Terrible Thing. That's on there.
I need to read that. I need to get on that.
Yeah.
Some Red Sonja.
I read that zombie one today, the zombie anthology. That's quite interesting.
Oh, yeah. Zed Time?
That's the one. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was expecting some sort of generic Walking Dead stuff, and it's anything but.
Oh, that's good.
Nice.
Yeah, check that out.
He's going for a pool quote again. Do you notice that?
Yeah. Little Hero. I'm getting a pool.
Nice. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in that.
The Little Heroes Anthology, of course, which is a brilliant charity book, isn't it? And they've got a Kickstarter currently going at the moment, haven't they? Which needs a bit of love.
It does. Yeah. Needs some love. Yeah. Definitely get on it. Yeah.
So go all to the banners for that. Get behind it.
Yeah. We are full supporters.
Kids for comics. Yeah. Comics for kids, even. Almost fucked up. I think I got away with it.
I don't think you have gone away with it if you mention it.
I don't do comics for kids anyway. That's made up.
Why? All comics are for kids.
Wow. Future Quake, that's on there.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Neonomicon's not for kids.
Hey?
I said the Neonomicon's not for kids.
Could be.
Lord.
If it was sort of flowers in the attic kind of kids, that'd be fine.
Oh, my God, God.
I'll tell you what I watched today. I watched Old Boy, the remake.
Why?
Well, Josh Brolin. I don't know. It was on, sorry?
Josh Brolin.
Yeah. If you want to see more of The Scarlet Witch, watch that movie. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Oh.
I want to
see quite a lot of The Scarlet Witch. Watch that movie.
But if you want a load of great independent comics, then you should check out comichouse.com. Yes. If you, the app has a 14-day free trial, and it's only £3 a month to get the app. So go and check them out today. And as always, Comic House, we're so sorry for this.
Yeah. I thought it went all right.
Yeah, it went all right. You know, I felt like Nero watching Rome burn.
Yeah. Speaking of the Netflix comics, you haven't watched Luke Cage series 2 yet, have you?
No.
All right.
And we don't know I don't know. I'm just not fussed about it at the moment.
I haven't seen much about it actually online. Have you? I thought, right, I'm going to fucking cram it to my face for a day, and I'm up to episode 8. And there's nothing. There's been no spoilers online, so I thought,
It was fairly similar with Jessica Jones, though, wasn't it? Jessica Jones just kind of appeared.
Didn't it?
Yeah.
But, speaking of Netflix, we spoke about like Luke Cage the last series, but it seemed to be like a series of build-ups, and then they just fudged out on it and went did something else. It's like, this is gonna happen, and no, it didn't. Now this is gonna happen. Oh, it didn't. And it's kind of that to the end of the series. It had its moments. Don't get me wrong, but
It's got some good people in it. It's a bit like the Jessica Jones series too. I quite like everyone in it. It's just sort of Jessica Jones series just went around in circles.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll leave that. I'll talk about that another time because nobody's clearly seen it.
No.
Yeah.
Maybe next week. I've been watching that fucking Staircase, which is just so bloody depressing.
Is it?
Well, it's kind of fun the next bit, and then as it goes on, it's just like, fucking hell, kill me. It's really, really depressing.
Is it a film about me with my third wife?
Well, it's about a man who gets accused of murdering his wife.
Oh no, that would be the opposite way around
me. Yeah, well, why did she try to murder you?
She was quite violent, my third wife, She's in a mental hospital now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Which will tie into the competition we got later. No, it won't.
And also, speaking of Netflix, they showed the first two episodes of Hilda at an event I was at this weekend, and it went down a storm.
Yes, speaking of that event, you got out and about. I mean,
event.
Yeah, let's speak about that event. Where did you go, Tony?
I went to the East London Comic Art Festival, LCAF, 2018. It was very good.
Tell us more, because we've heard a little bit about it, but give us a rundown, and then we've got a little bit of an extra surprise, don't we, for our listeners?
Oh, yeah. A couple of little saucy surprises, haven't we?
Oh,
yeah. I'll tell you what, and we'll talk about this in a minute, it was packed out.
Yeah.
I got there for opening on Friday. It doesn't open till 12. Now, that's an interesting dynamic as well. It opens on. It actually opened at 11:45 on the first day because people were queuing up to see Hilda. So they opened a bit early just to sort of let everyone in to see it.
Yeah.
But it opened at 12. Now, that's an interesting time. Everyone quite liked that because the nature of a lot of comic people is they're not really early risers, are they?
Yeah.
Or people who are prompt.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was good. And I went Friday and Saturday. I didn't go today. Today's Sunday. And I had a wander around. And it was one of those ones where walked around and around, chatted to people nonstop. Obviously, hooked up with the Nobrow people who are friends of mine. And also chatted to people like Poyaji and Todd, who will hear Andy Poyaji and Todd Oliver, who we'll hear from in a minute. Jens K. Stive, who's the bloke who did Dunce from a few weeks ago, I talked about. They were there.
Nice.
Centrala was there. Had a good chat with them. Henry and Stanley Miller, who I reviewed their books recently, The Aphid and a book called Darren about shopping for star bars, which is quite a cool little book. And it was one of those ones that just sort of turns into sort of sitting outside and chatting to people. And then they'd head off and someone else would come and chat. I think yesterday I intended to have like a 10-minute conversation with Simon Russell when he goes, and about sort of half an hour into it, he goes, "Should we just get a beer?" So we sort of sat outside and then people came and joined us and we chatted to people who came past, and Josh Hicks came past and Sarah Harris came past and all these sort of people. And I looked at my watch and it was like 4:00. And it's just one of those sort of, it was nice summer's day. They have like booze tents outside and you sort of sit there and everyone comes past. Tim Bird was there. Properly good. Had a really good time. But the one thing I wanted to talk to you guys about was, this is speaking to Angela, big shout out to Angela who runs the event. She was saying this is the busiest Friday they've ever had. I think it might be the sixth one off the top of my head. Now, in a year of dwindling footfall at conventions.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of theories, but why do you guys think that? You know, looking at it from the outside, why would you think it is?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
If I kind of straight away, I'd say that maybe El Cap's offering up just that kind of small press, indie zine kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's what they do, and that's what they're known for.
Yeah.
And that's what people are going there for. That's not
combining
sort of
it.
Slight...
No, it's Go not. On. It's combining it with that sort of illustration fair feel.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think
crafty kind of thing.
Comics, from my perspective, is always sort of peaks and troughs of like what's popular, what isn't, blah blah blah. And I think that sort of zine, the illustration ones, you know, those biographical comics and that kind of stuff, has probably never been more popular. I know it's always been popular with a certain crowd and stuff, but it's certainly it's at the zeitgeist. You're probably seeing more of those books in a Waterstones now than you ever were before. Do you know what I mean? It's hitting the mainstream, but still having this sort of like, you know, independent feel to it. So I think it's riding high on the wave of popularity.
Yeah, I think people like No Brow are considered the cool crowd, aren't they? Mm. And people like Jonathan Cape. And even, you know, well, not even, but and Avery Hill and people like that are seen as Centrala. Yeah. And, you know, they're seen as the cool crowd now, aren't they? People who aren't necessarily the people you see in a comic shop, or you see people buying comics on, you know, Comixology or something like that are going to go down and look for something that they consider to be almost cool and quirky because it makes them cool and quirky, maybe.
Yeah. Just the kind of things that get written about by in The Guardian, like the comics themselves, whereas... other stuff, the smaller press comics won't. There's no chance of them appearing.
They're the sort of comics that don't want to be known. Well, some of them, I would say, like if The Guardian's talking about it, they won't say comics; they'll say graphic novels. They'll be that. You know, they don't want to associate themselves with the term comic because comic has that sort of a more simplistic.
I think that's a sad state because if you speak to anyone who's actually cemented in the scene, you know, I was speaking to Dave White and Ricky Miller and all these sort of guys, you know, and they have a pull list of comics at a comic shop, and they do read Marvel, DC, Vertigo, you know, these sort of titles, Image Comics, you know,
they're publishing,
it's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah, because they're publishing these titles that they don't see. They love like the Marvel and DC books and all of that, you know, they get them, but they're publishing stuff that isn't like anything else. That's why they're publishing it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's
And I think they would. I mean, we had a big conversation about the 2000 AD Summer Special that's just come out. You know, I actually had the conversation with a couple of people. You know, and I'm thinking, the divide is less than you think sometimes. You know, I think it's made something by the people with, you know, the flowery shirts and the baseball caps who turn up with the, you know, horn rimmed glasses. You know, who like to just hit a scene rather than invest in the medium, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, but a couple of other reasons I think are location.
Mm-hmm.
I think the location, it being trendy East London. And it's not an easy place to get to. There's no tube. It's a 10-15 minute walk from a tube station where you are. You know, it's not like adjacent to, you know, you have to get a bus there sort of thing. So it's not an easy, you know, really easy place to get to, but it is in the heart of, you know, craft breweries and, you know, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that is a really big thing. And I think also the fact that they ran a load of events on the way up to it. So we had stuff like the exhibition and the gig and all this sort of thing on the way up to it. And they got a bit of a buzz. And also they are an established comic company who employ staff whose job is purely to curate and run the convention. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're already hooked into the comic company and they're running a convention. So they're at a winner already, you know. So they've got that group of people who are followed, like Luke. I mean, I know Luke Pearson wasn't there, but for example, Luke Healy and all these sort of people who are followed by people, and they know they're already going to get a good lineup of guests.
Yeah,
I think that might be part of it.
Mm.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, mate, it's great
having the.
Yes, it's like a little version of it's like a little version of True Believers. So you've got that balcony above it all, so you can sit there and read. And it's got the sort of busy floor and they do workshops and talks and little screenings and, you know, people come from a long way away just to get to it. You know, there's a lot of people talking about booking Airbnbs to go to it and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah. It's some really nice sort of creative vibe to it. And it's not, I think Sarah was saying to me, Sarah Harris came down, I think for the Saturday, you know, she was there for the Friday, but she was saying she was a bit sort of, she thought, oh, well, I like it, I'm going to be definitely be the oldest person there.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the fact I was there, so I clearly was, but she sort of, afterwards, she said, no, she said it was good. She liked it. She said, you know, she was, everyone was really nice, you know, everyone was friendly. Yeah. I noticed that they have like a security guard. I'm not sure if he's something to do with the venue, who wears a sort of suit and wanders around. And even he was like chatting to people, I noticed at one point, and a big smile on his face. And yeah, no, it's good. They get there. There's a little brewery that runs a stall, so they sell. Yeah. So they had Elcaf beer this year.
Yeah.
Which is quite cool.
I mean, atmosphere goes a long way, doesn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. I think it was, if there's good vibes, everyone's sort of like in a real good mood.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was that beer then?
I think it's a pale ale or something, I think. Elcaf beer. Sam from No Brow is very excited by it.
Did you try any?
No, I didn't have any. I had some rhubarb.
Baby sham? You had baby sham?
Yeah. I had a proper hipster rhubarb soft drink, but no, I didn't have any of the Elcaf beer. But it was busy people drinking it left, right, and centre. You saw everyone had some on their tables and all that, you know. There was a DJ there. I find that all a bit annoying.
Well,
I sent you a video of it, didn't I?
Yeah, but. Was it too loud? Is that the issue?
No, it was okay, actually. It was all right.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was all right. You do feel like saying to them occasionally, have you got another fucking record, mate? But it was all right. No, in my old grumpiness, I did think, oh, DJ. And he was quite nice, especially when you're sitting up there because they had a load of fans on the top floor because it's hot, you know, hot weekend.
Yeah.
And all the fans were going, I was sitting there reading a comic and that was in the background. It's quite nice. Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah. Do you think weather played a part? Because obviously you do Elcaf every year, don't you? It's always around this time of year, so it should always be around that sort of height of summer or when we've got good weather over here in the UK.
Yeah. I think that's a big shout. I think that's a big part of it. And I think people know that Elcaf's happening, so they avoid of the same sort of area of the medium. They sort of avoid clashing with it.
Yeah,
I think because they announced quite early. But yeah, I think we had one year where it literally had one of those sort of summer showers of rain where it just like kicked down for about an hour, and everyone sort of hid under tents and stuff. But it was lovely to sit outside, and there was loads of seating, and nobody was. There was a lot of beggars because it's Hackney. There's a lot of sort of junky beggars, backs and forwards. But after a while, they just fucked off, you know.
We
ain't got no money.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, figured it out. Yeah.
So you obviously got a good chunk of books like you always do.
Yeah, I got a pot.
But what you also got on the date was a bit of cheeky audio, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I got two bits of audio. Should we go with Todd's bit first? What do you think?
Why not? Why not?
Yeah. So our friend Todd Oliver was there.
Yeah.
And he's got a new book out. I love Todd's work. And I think I'll probably say this again later, but there's a couple of people who I saw they had a book out. I bought it, ran upstairs and read it straight away. And Smedley, The Story of a Worm-Shaped Man, is properly fucked up. It's
nice.
It's boxes level funny.
Yeah.
But it's a perfect band. So it's like a bookshelf kind of book. It's nice. Yeah, really good. Yeah, so I had a chat with him. And then after that, I had a chat with Andy Puyagi, who's an old school friend of mine. I've known Andy for donkey's years. In fact, he's the one who first put me in contact with No Brow, got me introduced to them and got me some review copies and stuff like that after he did a book with them, which we talk about. And he's a very thoughtful guy, Andy. I really like him. A really, really interesting person. He's one of those guys we always sort of talk about getting him on. We must get him on one day for a long form chat.
Yeah,
It's quite influential in the sort of the London scene. Very good. Here you go. I'm here with Todd Oliver. It's almost like a tradition on the Friday of Elcaf. We do an interview about your new comic.
Yeah,
is it? Yeah. So you've got Smedley, The Story of a Worm-Shaped Man.
Yeah.
Did you want to tell us? I've just read it incidentally, and it's very good.
Oh, you like it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So it's the letterbox incident at the start.
Yeah.
Did you just want to tell the reader a little bit about it, the listeners about it?
Okay, so Smedley is. A character that appeared originally in boxes, and I just thought, rather than him just being a two-dimensional character, to try and give him a little bit of depth, explain his backstory, more his day-to-day life, what he gets up to, and
he's searching for a job, isn't he? Is that how it starts?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, he goes through a succession of jobs, losing them, and then starts to kind of. Get involved in some unsavoury types really. And yeah, it all starts to go downhill from there, really. But it is very, would you think it's fair to say pure? It's puerile. I think Andy Oliver, Broken Frontier, was saying it's very scatological, which are...
It's puerile, but you know it's puerile, which it makes it almost like a different thing, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and but I also, I'd like to think it's still weird enough to stand out from the crowd, and I'm not doing the weirdness for as a gimmick. This is, it's just who I am, and it seems to linger on anything that I touch.
No, I loved it, and it starts, I don't know if we ruined it, but it starts with him at the job centre, having to explain why he lost his job for breaking into a house and doing a poo on the carpet. Is that right?
No, he gets involved in an altercation with a dog. Yeah, and he seeks solace through a letterbox. Being a worm-shaped man, he can kind of slot in through a letterbox, and he ends up making a mess of somebody's house because of the altercation.
That sounds quite lively, but it, literally things get worse from there on, don't they?
Yeah, they do, and start to feel a little bit sorry for Wormman towards the end, because he realises he can't really get out of this situation that he's stuck in. So I've already penciled part two.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I know where the story's going to go, but really I'm kind of at a crossroads right now with regards to if I want to tackle that. You know, that's going to be another 7-8 plus months of my time.
We talked about earlier, you were thinking about maybe including a sort of webcomic aspect to your hobby, I suppose?
Yeah, so like, I've been dabbling in, just in between part one and two now, so part one's obviously finished, and I was going to originally just start part two, but there was something, I don't know why, I think I just sat at work at the desk and I just thought, like, I want to do something, have an instant hit of... recognition, you know, I want to post something. So I've done a couple of little web comics, and I quite like the pace that I can just do something one day, throw it out there, get some feedback, and move on with the next thing again.
But there's only good publicity for your printed product as well, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And I've been posting my stuff on Instagram anyway, but more recently I've been posting on Reddit as well, which I think is quite an untapped market with regards to where I've been putting my work.
Okay.
And straight off the back of the first time I actually posted something on Reddit, it got a modest amount of, not likes, upvotes, but I also got one sale, but about 3 or 4 comics worth of, of sales. So
you think a webcomic about Smedley, or will it be something else, or?
More akin to what I've done with boxes, so individual stories, maybe reoccurring characters, but really it's that they stick to a 3x3, so 9-panel format, and whatever I can just fit into those 9 panels for whatever I feel like on the day, really.
But you've been experimenting a bit with that on Instagram, haven't you? You've stuck a few more of recent times, actually. You've stuck some strips on there, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. So like the last 2 comics I've worked on, I've just stuck them on there, and I realised that, like, yeah, I'm giving it away for free, but in all honesty, with the comics, yes, I'm printing them, and yes, that costs money, but it's never really been first and foremost thought in my head that I want to make money from these things. I'm so happy just for someone to buy it and be able to put the money towards print run. But really, this, I'm almost giving stuff away, because any money, any profit that I make gets eaten into travel expenses for the next convention, or, you know, or a hotel for
hookers and blow.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, you know me well.
Nice one, man. I love it. I've just read it. I bought it off you about an hour ago, and I've just read it upstairs. Yeah, really, really good. Where can people buy it? Because I recommend it.
So, toddoliver.bigcartel.com is where you want to go if you want to buy it online. Otherwise. The only other convention that I've got lined up at the moment is Thought Bubble, so you better buy it there too. Cheers, thank you.
I'm here with Andy Puyagi. Andy, it's taken, what, about... you're a professor, so you know what to say. It's taken about 3 years to get you on the pod. We're always talking about you, and I've reviewed loads of your books.
Yeah, no, I've been listening to it, and I appreciate that. Yeah, so thank you for, like, having me on. Cool. Yeah.
Now, I first got to know you, I think, with Lost Property, which is a book you did. We're sitting outside Elka for the moment, so it's a book you did with Nobrow, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Actually, that came about, I think it might have come about through one of the Elkafs, I think. it might have been the first or second Alcaf, so probably about five or six years ago, and I was here tabling. It was one of the first exhibitions that I'd done, and had like my first few self-published pieces, and I think I dropped off some of the stuff at the Nobrow table.
Oh, okay.
Like with a view just to like getting some of my stuff out there, with no kind of expectation of them reading it, but I just thought I wanted to like chance it really.
Yeah.
And actually I think it was probably about a year later, after maybe doing the next LCAF, I got a call from Alex, who before he went to the States.
Oh, okay.
And when he was still working with Sam in London, I got a call from him about doing one of the 2020 God, I forget what it is now. 20
times 17, whatever they are.
Yeah. 17 by 23.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I'm forgetting my size, my format.
I think they're not doing any more at the moment, but it was like a comic run of single one-off stories, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was an effort to get new creators kind of on board, give them an opportunity to tell a kind of a short story of 24 pages, and with a view to maybe like doing a longer piece after that.
Yeah.
So I was given the opportunity, off the back of the self-published bits that I'd done, to have a crack at it. And it was amazing. Like, I was like, I really didn't expect it, and was obviously very flattered to be asked by them, because I love their books, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a great opportunity for me, and so I went for it, yeah. And worked on a couple of ideas at the time. Sort of gave them two different stories, and they picked the lost property approach, and then I just worked on that.
Okay, so they went for the poster. Did you want to just tell the listener what it's about? This, because I think I reviewed it about 2 years ago, so not everyone will have heard.
Yeah, it's about a guy, a postman, who discovers every object he ever owned in his whole life hidden in the basement of a local lost property office.
Right.
So the story is sort of about why those objects got there, how they got there. And sort of exploring his past and his journey to where he is today, and what he does, and what his sort of passions are. So it's kind of about, you know, your past and your memories through the kind of objects and possessions you've owned.
Yeah.
It's kind of like magical realism, I think, is what you'd call it.
And it's beautiful, isn't it? And I remember talking to you at the time, and you telling me that the one thing that really took some time on it was the colouring. Did it come out of the tea stories thing? You developed almost like colours for it, sort of.
Yeah, that's right. So the first comic I did was Teapot Therapy, which was like for the Observer Graphic Short Story Prize, and I used real tea washes to colour that in.
That's right.
I sort of did washes with real tea, scanned them in, and then like tweaked them in Photoshop and changed the colours. And so I kind of used the same layering technique on other stuff, including Lost Property, and it's actually the same tea textures in Lost Property, but you can't really tell it's tea because of the colours.
You wouldn't look at it and think, oh, that's definitely a tea bag, would you? But that's a real sort of attention to detail, though. Is that something that you find you become a little bit obsessive when you're doing a comic sometimes, or?
Yeah, and it's not something I enjoy. It's not like I chose, like, oh, I want to work this way and then I work that way. It was like basically finding my way, trying to figure out how the hell to do it the first time round, not really knowing what I was doing.
Okay.
And then once I found a system that looked vaguely acceptable, that's all I know.
Okay.
And sort of try to refine it for Lost Property, I guess, was the process.
Yeah.
So, and it's not very economical, which is why it takes me a long time.
Right, okay.
And since Lost Property, I think with the newer projects, I've tried to simplify it, probably simplify the colour palette, and so that it's easier to do, which is why more recent stuff is probably a bit simpler looking in terms of colour. The thing I'm doing right now is probably back to Lost Property style colours, in that it's a bit more considered and detailed.
Right, okay.
For my sins.
So you went on to that from... I can't remember. Was it Viripathy came after that? Was it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That was an attempt to try and do something a bit simpler looking in terms of the colour.
Okay.
All round, really.
Two colours. Black and white. Yeah.
Each story is kind of different. It's different colours, but there's a lot of monochrome in there, so it took me a lot less time. And that was sort of in an effort to do something in a month. I think I did Viripathy in a month, as opposed to months and months and months, which is what Lost Property took. So they felt quite nice to do something quickly.
To me, Viripathy was sort of evident of you being a deep thinker about stuff, because it was incredibly thoughtful, and there was a lot, there was so much in it that related to emotions and how people deal with each other and realities of how things happen. But it was in quite a short book. I mean, a lot of people would, that would be a 10-year project at Marvel, or, you know, do you know what I mean? It's like, but yeah, there were so many ideas in it. How did you come up with that? For those who don't realise, it's a helmet that you wear that allows you to understand the feelings and the pain that the other person is feeling. Is that
it's
right?
It's like a fictionalised sort of VR headset. That you put on, it allows you to kind of feel what other people are feeling, so you can tap into other people's feelings, emotions. And it's kind of not an original idea. It's a sort of thing like, you know, sort of thing you'd see on Black Mirror on the show, or another, or countless other sort of sci-fi, dark sci-fi shows.
Well,
so
you're doing yourself a bit of a disservice there, because it would seem very fresh and original.
Thanks.
Do you know what I mean?
I appreciate that. But I guess like my take on it was just to think about how it would affect people emotionally. I think that's how I kind of think when it comes to my small stories. It's like trying to get to the core of an emotion or a feeling that resonates with me. I think that's how I sort of write stuff. And again, it's not like an explicit intention. It just sort of comes out that way, and that's what feels appropriate for stuff.
You just think through how someone would react to something. Is that how it starts for you, or?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm sort of trying to think back now. Yeah. One of the stories is about a guy who goes to see one of these, goes to a facility where they use these helmets in order as a form of therapy.
Yeah.
And there's a guy who is kind of able to know exactly what your pain and your feelings are, and as a result kind of help you get rid of them. And he says it's like any form of therapy really, but by using this bit of technology. So for me, it was like,
but people lie to therapists, don't they? That's the thing. For me, that's the clever bit of it. You go and see a psychologist with a problem, not everyone's truthful, are they? Do you know what I mean?
I guess, I mean, I'm not sure that I thought about it that way, so that's very insightful, Toby. But yeah, for me, it was about like, what if someone was able to take away this pain? Like, what if you were able to really open up to someone? I mean, I find often like the stuff I come out with is quite reflective of what I'm going through at the time.
Yeah.
When I don't even realise it. Okay. I mean, it's probably painfully obvious for people who read it, certainly for people who know me and see it.
Okay.
But it when I look back at it, it's like, oh, gee, it's like, actually, God, so obviously something I was really, really thinking about, and it just sort of came out in this story.
In retrospect, you realise.
Yeah. Especially
it's almost therapy itself then, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
it's
got
that meta-meaning to it, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. Yeah, it is. I think maybe that's a value that it has for creators, you know, that process of sort of getting it out, and you're kind of like figuring it out for yourself, and you're exploring stuff that matters to you.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't think there's a piece of art that isn't well done unless it has a piece of the artist in it somewhere.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
Yeah. Even without the artist knowing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's there. It's present. So it's not like a, again, it's not like a conscious, that isn't a conscious process, like what's troubling me, or I better get this out in a comic. It just happens, you know, it comes out through the vehicle of, oh, I like the idea of a bit of technology that you put on your, stick on your head, you know what I mean? That's the starting, that's how it starts.
That's and then a cool looking helmet almost, yeah, because it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it starts off in quite a superficial visual level, and then hopefully it ends
up something.
You
get in the weeds of it after that almost.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So what's next? What have you got next, Andy?
Yeah, so I'm just sort of started working on a serialised comic for a magazine. Which is sort of going to be coming out monthly, not in the UK, abroad, which is quite interesting.
Okay, bit of a secret project at the moment?
No, it's not. It's actually for the big issue in Taiwan.
Bloody
which
hell.
Is really unusual, yeah. And this was...
I didn't realise they had a homeless problem in Taiwan.
Yeah, they do globally, unfortunately. So it's the same big issue as over here, but it's a very different looking magazine.
Okay.
It's quite coffee table looking and full of illustration and comics. The editor in particular, who is a lovely guy, really values comics. And they have like a comics artist in residence every 6 months. They'll get someone to do a one long story over the course of six issues. So yeah, they got in touch with me out of the blue and asked if I'd want to be involved, and I was like, what, the big issue? So I mean, it was like I had no idea the kind of work that might be in it, in my sort of ignorance. But they had some incredible, like, well-known comics creators on there.
Okay.
Yeah, like Julie Morrow from Blue's The Warmest Colour.
Oh, right.
And Bianca Bagnarelli, who did a No Pad and No Brow book.
Oh, okay.
Out,
right.
Yeah,
oh,
part of the same series. So I was like, wow, what a great opportunity. So yeah, I'm sort of working on that at the moment. And then with a view to kind of like publishing it over here as a collection. As one bigger story next year.
Real. Have you got an idea for a publisher for that, or?
No, nothing set in stone. You know, okay. I've been talking to people, but it's going to be kind of lost property length, so it's not like a big fat book or anything.
Yeah.
So it's not like a, you know, I'm not sure what space it kind of fits in.
Yeah. That's brilliant, man.
Yeah. So
great news. Where can people find you online, and where can they get your products and stuff like that?
You can find me. It's ajpoyaji.com. That's the website. And there's a link to an Etsy shop on there. I'm also on Twitter, Instagram as ajpoyaji. You can find sort of images of stuff and links of stuff on there. So yeah, have a look.
Thanks, man. About time.
Thanks, Tony. Yeah, thank you for having me, mate.
Well done, Tony. Our boy, the roving reporter.
Little bit of wind on the interview there with, but that wasn't me, it was the actual wind.
Well, you know, it might be those cucumber sandwiches, you never know.
Yeah.
No, top stuff though. I mean, I really need to make it to LCAF one. Yeah.
You'd really know, it's a real social one, yeah, really fun,
yeah.
But
and the sun was out, so sun, seeing comics.
Did you burn your little fella this week? You were telling me,
or no, because I didn't bring you with me.
Oh, yeah.
Get the old man out in the sun.
Yeah.
A bit of the sun because...
I worked with a guy called Noodles. He burnt it once when he went sunbathing.
Why would you... Oh, do you know what? I'm not... I was about to question it, but why would I ask about it? I just don't know.
Just... He didn't know to make it up, but I'll tell everyone, so it's quite funny.
Yeah. Well, no one suspects it's you if you talk about other people, do you? So.
That's it, yeah. Yeah, but it's actually me. He's burnt my knob.
Oh dear, more on that later. But first we've got an exciting interview for you now. We've been meaning to get these guys on the show for a long time, and I know a lot of our listeners out there love their stuff and has probably pledged on one of the Kickstarters we're going to talk about.
Have they had a Kickstarter?
Yeah, they may have. Yes. So here it is for your listening pleasure, folks. We managed to sit down and talk to the Etherington brothers to talk about their comics and how they got started. So, without further ado, let's get stuck in. Cue the excitement cannons, folks, because this week we're joined by two creators who are no stranger to the convention circuit. I would call them ambassadors of the comic creating medium, and they're also known for their work in The Phoenix, Long Gone Done, Von Dugan, Luger and Beruga, call this a mouthful, Stransky, and so much more. Yes, it's our distinct pleasure to welcome Robin and Lorenzo, who are also known as the Etherington brothers, to the show. Hello, gents.
Hey.
Yay! Woo! They're the best! Oh, hi. Thank you for having us. Shut up, studio audience. Thank you very much for having us on your lovely little show. We're very pleased to be here.
That's Robin talking.
Yes.
My name is Robin.
Yeah. And I'm Lorenzo, just so you know our different voices. I've got the low, manly voice.
Got the other voice!
Sure, I had a feeling this episode was going to be like this.
I'm sort of the comics version of Little Britain already.
That's what we've always aimed for. So there we go. At last, it's made its way into the public consciousness. Yeah. I'm delighted.
Brilliant. Well, I know a lot of our listeners are big fans of your work, and have probably pledged to your Kickstarter. And like we say, not only are the Etheringtons responsible for the UK's most successful comics Kickstarter of all time, something we're going to cover in a little bit, even if it's just talking about the amount of packing materials that they've bought recently. but we've been meaning to have them on the show for a long time to talk about their love of all comics, great and small. So I think just to kick us off, let's start with the origin story. What was it that got you both into comics?
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay. I'll begin. Robin shall begin telling the tale of the brothers. It was 1982. I was 6 years old. My brother was three. I wasn't talking to him at that phase. We'd had a falling out.
And I wasn't talking yet.
So. He wasn't talking either. That worked in my favour. The one and only time I've dominated. We grew up in the UK, very classic comic background. We were, you know, we had piles, the deluge of Beanos and Dandies. And I was kind of coming out in the 70s bit. So I had Battle and War and old copies of, you know, the Commando Picture Library. And we had everything, you know, all the usual stuff, Wizards and Chips, you know, all of that stuff. And, you know, that was kind of like our staple. That was absolutely our grounding, same as everybody else. And it just happened that we had an older brother. We still have an older brother. If you're out there, William, I didn't say you died. I love you.
Is he like the missing Marx brother? You know, the one that didn't make it into the later movies?
Is. He is, and I think he chose that purposefully.
I mean, if you go use a modern reference, they're like the Hemsworths. He's the Hemsworth that's in Westworld. That no one talks about.
He's more like Bill Watterson. Good luck trying to find him. He's out there somewhere hiding from the creativity. He actually was a major influence on us because he brought Asterix directly into our line of fire very early on. And where our folks actually were gave us Tintin and brought that into our lives, he brought Asterix in. And I feel, for me, definitely.
And Calvin and Hobbes
later as well, yeah. So we had two really big...
Kevin and Hobbes!
Hobbs in the house! Kevin! We keep trying to find a perfect way to say Calvin and Hobbes, and I don't think we've got there yet, but we're working on it. Kevin and Hobbes! those two storytelling styles, the kind of... the very, very... professional turnout of Goscinny and Uderzo, certainly in those first seven books on Asterix, where they were just so good out the box. They'd already had a series between them they'd been working on before that, but something about Asterix, it just struck such a chord with us. The sense of humor, the world building, the being able to drop back into a world, to a universe, different books, and the quality that never dipped and was perpetually engaging on so many different levels, and like 12 different ways of telling a joke in every book, in every page. And
the pages were packed, weren't they, as well? A bit like your work. I can see that reflected in yours, guys.
I think we packed ours even more. Like, and I think over time we've been strimming back, trying to find the perfect sweet spot. Cause you know, we know word art balance is so vital, but
yeah,
I think it wasn't until we really went back to the drawing board, and certainly from my point of view, from a scripting point of view, really went back to study some of those early books that I'd really been influenced by, and just really, you know, discovered.
You're jumping around the origin story.
I'm going back. I'm six years old. Asterix, Tintin, all that stuff. Meanwhile, Lorenzo came across the work of Frank Hampson and obviously Dan Dare, and that changed things for him. So I'll hand over at that point to Lorenzo.
Oh yeah. Okay. So Robin and I, like Robin said, we grew up like looking at comics, and I got really into like Dan Dare and the old sort of comics from the 1950s. And again,
was that through 2000 AD's version?
No. It was I wandered into a book shop. Actually, it wasn't a book shop. It was just like a gift shop or something one day.
Okay.
And a company called Hawk did these reprints, these massive reprints of the Dan Dare series, these huge books in sort of the 90s, and I just came across one, and I was like, oh my god, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And it was the same through line of just like the quality that was being invested in a book that was ostensibly just for kids, you know, really struck a chord with you. So we sort of continued doing that.
We struck a lot of chords.
So we continued making comics together as kids, and we started like photocopying them and selling them to our friends in the playground. And then we kind of went off and did a lot of other stuff as we both went to university and studied different things and art school and stuff. And then we kind of came back together, very much going straight into the indie scene, just making comics together, because we missed, like, you grow up as brothers, you've got so many like common touch points that you've shared, and I think it's not until you're out in the world that you realize how precious that is, and how most people don't have it, and the people that do have it, they don't even talk to their brothers. And so we're like, man, we still love the same stuff, and we're not doing it, and we're not making anything together anymore, and let's start doing that. And so then we started doing it indie, doing the indie shows. And
so what shows were them? Give us a time frame for that.
I was living in Bristol, so this was like 2004
when we did our first show. Still the Expo was going then, yeah.
It was still the Expo, and the Expo was about to get really big over sort of 2-3 years. So that was great because we didn't have cars at that point, so yeah, we didn't have to travel or anything. So it was right.
Was that when it was in the train station? It was in the train station.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so we in the engine shed, and we used to do we do that show, and we do a few others dotted around. We did Birmingham, we did a few others, but mostly our focus was sort of 4 or 5 shows in the year. And what we did was, because it's very difficult to sell comics on the internet at that point, it wasn't really you know, social media wasn't there, so it was very difficult unless you had a huge web strip, and we weren't really doing a web strip. It was difficult to build an audience, so we were, let alone sell books and stuff. And so we were really relied on the cons. And what we do is we'd focus on each con coming up and go, right, we've got to get our next issue done for that, and then we put more cons in, and so we had to do more issues in that year. And so we did that for about 3 years.
How was the reception then? How did you find it then?
Well, back then it was very, very, very.
Are you going to be different?
Yeah, it was a very the audience at those cons was very focused on a few titles. They were very focused on 2000 AD, and they were focused on some Marvel stuff, and there wasn't really any independent stuff like you see it now. If you step through Thought Bubble now into Thought Bubble, that wasn't there. It didn't exist at all, and certainly not colourful, stupid comics about rabbits and, you know, stuff like we were starting to make. And
what was the comic that you had at your first show then?
That was Malcolm. That was this comic called Malcolm Magic, which was a black and white very, very crazy indie comic, like everybody does with their first comic. We threw everything we could into it, and we would
just got a bit bigger than most.
It just went on and on. And what we did was we both worked doing part-time jobs, and I suddenly discovered that my brother Robin was actually the best salesman I've ever met, in that he could take a guy who'd just come there to get his Judge Dredd comic signed, and he could sell him all 10 of our comics about this rabbit. And the guy, he wasn't even angry, he said thanks to us. So I'm gonna hand Robin over to explain how we sort of started to realize that we could, like, it wasn't about someone coming through the door who wanted to read Malcolm Magic. It was about introducing someone to something new in a way that they got interested in it, and then gave us all their money. So
that is one of the clumsiest links I've ever had, but I'm gonna go with it.
Some of our shows, bloody hell.
It's not about being professional, it's about being enthusiastic. That's what gets us through the cold nights. So yeah, I mean, those early shows were special. I mean, what the real change for us was, we'd actually been working on a completely different title the year before, a very straight title, very cliffhanger, Wildstorm comics influence. That's the stuff that we've been seeing in the shots that we've been really excited by, battle chasers, all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
All that stuff. Yeah, and Danger Girl, all that kind of stuff. And we were like, we thought it was, you know, that was where comics were and where they were exciting and where they might be going. So we started working on that. And actually, the year before, we went to the Bristol show just to kind of tout our portfolio. And there we were extremely lucky, that because Jeff Smith of Bone fame was over doing a presentation. And we were really, you know, we're lucky. We sat in there and it literally just changed everything. It was like everything he said and everything he enthused about what it means to be independent and to create this the thing that is for you primarily, absolutely out the door. You are not thinking of the audience, you are thinking about, what does this do for me creatively? Where am I getting my pleasure from? What am I adding to the space that feels fresh and new? It was enough for us to basically walk away from that thing, tear up everything we'd done, and start.
I still got it.
Oh, you still got it, yeah. And the pages will be available on eBay at a reasonable starting rate. No reserve. We just down tools on that, and we went, no, this is wrong. We've completely forgotten what it was that we loved, and it was the funny, it was the humour. It was the anthropomorphic storytelling. It was all that stuff. It was the yucks, And so we rebooted. And, I remember we went to that first show in 2004. And the room was full of, black T-shirt wearing comic fans who were there for about three, four titles. But back then, obviously, we weren't making anything for them. For starters, the covers of our comics were white. I mean, it was that much of a change that you could see it on people's faces looking at what we were making, just going, I have no idea how to deal with this. That's perfect. In that small moment where someone is lost and they're feeling fear, guilt and shame, at that moment, I can remove a crisp £5 note from their wallet.
You're like a predator.
I am like a sequential predator. I move one panel at a time, but the last panel always ends up with me holding your wallet. Do you know what we did? I know what we did because I can remember now because we haven't done it for years. This is what we did at the beginning. I was not behind the table. I was in front of the table. And it was such a simple thing that I was there at the table with the material, but I was standing up and I was in the space with the others and I could get chatting to people really quickly who were just near our table because nobody was stopping at our table because why would they? But just having those conversations, I was like bringing them in, luring them in. And maybe, I don't know. But it was just the change in the dynamic between how we were interacting with the audience gave us that first little in, and it got people just chatting to us. And a lot of them didn't buy that year. That was the crazy thing. A lot of people just chatted to us, had a look through, said, oh, no, it's not for me. But, of course, we just kept coming back to the shows. And eventually they said, do you know what? I can't believe this. Last time you had two issues, now you're on issue 7. Maybe I'll give it a go. And that was how we kind of over those 3 years just kind of got the beginnings of that first little group of readers who, most of those guys have followed us now for the whole career, which is amazing. But it was a really interesting time because we felt like there was probably about six other creative teams, I reckon, in that room who were making
them, dude.
I
have to say, I just to interrupt you there, I found that because I did it every year and I had a table with a pal and we would always have a new book out. And that was every time we did that convention, we'd have a new book out, if not two sometimes. Yeah, but you would back then, people didn't know, did they? You walk past their table.
It's hard work. And I think as well, I think a big part of it was the printing model was so archaic then that, you get guys would do a book and they'd have to print like 2,000 copies of it, and it's like, you're going to have to work really hard to sell 2,000 copies of a book at a Bristol Comic Convention in 2004. Like, so people...
We had 4,000 people through the door.
Yeah. So, and we most of their money, so it was I mean that and I think that model was really difficult, and that's why we our whole sort of model as we've gone through right up to doing these Kickstarters, which have scaled up and up to quite a big sort of level, is you don't take the next step in production until you can justify it. So when we were making Malcolm Magic, we literally printed that comic at home. We bought an A3 printer, we built a little book press, and we printed every copy of Malcolm until we did a final big collected version at the very end through Lulu. But like I looked at it, and I was like, we don't need to have 1,000 books because we're not going to sell 1,000 books, but we're going to sell a few hundred of each of these titles, and we got this many, and like let's just do it ourselves and once, and then you outgrow it, and then that's the time to jump up.
With that in mind, do you think that's something that would benefit some creators now? Because obviously we live in a world where everyone's got access to a digital print, some comic printing company or whatever, and the books are always coming out like you see in the comic book shops. But do you think some people run before they can walk in sometimes?
I think you get that in every creative industry because people doing, especially if they're doing it part-time, they've got money from an income, and so they can just drop money into it and produce, and so the production can be very high and it can often be ahead of what the work is. But I mean, I don't really think it's a problem. I don't think people benefit from doing it or not, because I think at the end of the day, what your book is sells it, not whether it's got a spot UV on the cover or whatever. But like, I think the difference is that if you've done it yourself, if you want to be independent, like I've always wanted to be super. I don't really like publishers. I don't really like the model. I don't love bookshops because I think everybody makes money, but creators. And so I don't, and in the old, back in the day, that's just how it was, but now it doesn't need to be like that because you can be independent and scale it massively. But I think that if you, and so I think if you want to do that, like actually printing a book yourself and understanding how simple it is and how, but at the same time, how you've got to sort of think about what you're doing and think about the numbers and think about production and all that stuff, really helps, because then when you're standing at a table selling it, you've really made something that you care about and you sell it better. Or rather, you talk, not selling it, but you talk to people about it with more understanding.
To be fair, there are plenty of creators who are still doing it. You know, you go to the thought bubbles of this world and you do see these guys. Absolutely. The handmade, bespoke, true indie stuff is out there, and it's different. It's different from what we were doing because...
I've been to LCAF this weekend. To LCAF, and that's exactly like that. Yeah, you can see people have actually cut it with scissors, and definitely.
I mean, well, I guess when we were doing that, what we were doing is we were trying to get as close to like a US format book as we could, but give it our flavour. So that's why we printed on cartridge stock paper, so it was thick and it was rich, and people were always commenting, "God, your comics feel so good." Now, that's not a thing people normally say about comics, because they're normally printed on the cheapest, thinnest papers they can get away with. But we realised that actually we knew that you have to have any edge you can get. Like Lawrence said, people wouldn't buy a book necessarily because it had Spot UV on it, but people sure picked ours up because they felt different, and they kept holding on to them because they felt different. And so some of that stuff does work in your favor. There is a very active indie scene that does believe in making, hand making.
There's a DIY scene, isn't there?
There really is. And they're just, they're not different from anybody else. They're just approaching it in a different way. And they will have a different conceit, as Lorenzo said, on the worth of the product they're putting in the hand of the person. But obviously, if the story's rubbish, people are still going to come back with the same feedback, and they're not going to, they're not going to come back. Yeah. So it's always a trade off. You've got to have the pages, you've got to have the material, but then after that, yes, taking that little bit of time to make it feel unique and special and learn about how it's made is definitely worthwhile.
Yeah, I tell you what, when I did mine, when probably about the same time as you were at Bristol, me and my mate would put it on a CD-ROM, and then I was the one with a car. So we'd drive it to Catford Print Centre and try and explain to the sort of South East London Cockney there, who probably just finished seeing Millwall, that we're doing a comic about a serial killer who kills famous people, and him just looking at us like we're a couple of weirdos. You know, there was a certain sort of growing up process going on there. Do you know what I mean?
And we were in
it together, and we were like against the world. You know, it was a bit like that, really. It was sort
yeah,
of,
well, that's it. That's what we always talk about. Like we know quite a few people who've come up, and they've got a little break in a different industry, and they leave comics and they never come back. And whenever we see them again or talk to them again, they always think about it wistfully, because they always think about it's like being in the trenches all the time.
You're in it
and you're fighting, and like, you're saying, you know, there are obviously a lot of solo creators out there, but there's a lot of teams. And if you're in that team, it's like, you know, you've got each other's back, and you know, you have to keep delivering, and you've got to keep working, and it's hard graft, and the shows are hard working, you know, it's all hard. But
the flipping rose tinted spectacles on those days, which were so hard. It's ridiculous. Now I'm like, it was amazing.
We're looking back and thinking, halcyon times. And yet I remember being at a comic convention in Brighton and watching as our 52-page print sheet backdrop slowly unpeeled itself and collapsed in the middle of selling to some people at a table. And you just kind of go, this is what it is. It's like, it's out there, it's indie, it's on the floor, and you get it done. And then obviously when things go good in different directions, that's great fun. You can enjoy that because you have worked for it, and you understand what it's all about. But we still love it. We're still turning up to these shows because we love it, so it's all good.
It's nice to have a couple of people behind a table. Like when we do it, the sales sometimes aren't brilliant, but because we have such a laugh. You mean because we're connecting and learning about comics and stuff?
You cannot guarantee sales. I can't even. I have lost count of how many shows we've done now. But if we think we're about to have a blinder, we have a stinker. If we think we're about to have a stinker, we have a blinder. Like, there's no rhyme nor reason to.
You can't figure it out, can you?
Really? 150 people can walk through a door, and every single one of them can have £200 in their wallet, and you just don't know. Or 4,000 people can walk through a door, and they're all there to see some guy talking who's come over from Spain. you know, and that's their whole show. And yeah, there is yeah. no way
yeah.
you to be able to predict show to show what's about to come your way.
Yeah, you're audience, you can't predict.
And that's kind of, it's good and bad at the same time. It would be nice sometimes, you know, we certainly would think it would be nice sometimes to go, oh, well, you know, we know that weekend's going to put that money on the table, which is great. But
it's quite consistent on shows, though, which makes you think it's the audience. You know, there are, the shows that are good for us, I think, the shows that are good pretty much every time we do them. And the shows that, the show yeah, I've ruined it now. and the shows that are quite well, we don't tend to go back to the shows that are really quite we go, no, it's true, but what we do here's what we do and I think you've got to be like, this is a business for a lot of people, and if yeah. it isn't a business, you're doing it as an indie, it's still important to get it right. Like if you do a show twice, 2 years in a row, and both times you're looking out and there's almost nobody coming through the door, and the people that are coming through the door, you can see they're not buying from you and they're not buying from anybody else, then that show doesn't have the reach. And frankly, like, don't like bad mouth the show or anything like that, but just don't go back until you start hearing people say, oh man, that show, you know, had a really good audience again. Because like the shows that really bother and get families there and get and really think about the culture of who's coming to the show and really push it, and don't just send a mail out to the same 500 people they've had on their mailing list since, you know, the noughties or whatever, like those shows, because those shows are getting massive, man. Those shows, you know, Thought Bubble was one of those shows, and like we did the Leamington Spa Con, which wasn't a big con, but man, that was an amazing audience coming around.
Yeah, okay. That was really good.
Yeah, but yeah, that's our approach is like you, it's unpredictable, but actually in a way it kind of is predictable. And if you keep going back to a show where you don't make any money, you're probably not going to make any more money. And if you're not bothered about money, you just want to see other creators that you love chatting to, because that's a really important part of all this stuff, then that's totally cool. But if you're going there and you're feeling disappointed each time, then it's like, well, you've got to try some other shows, because they're usually not that cheap to get to. The tables are usually pretty cheap on the smaller shows. Yeah. And there's some absolute crackers out there that we've been discovering where we're like, these shows are amazing. Oh, cool. They're small and they're good. I'm going to hand back to Bobby.
Yeah, no. I just want to say then, like going back to like when Lawrence talked about what, you know, when you choose to scale up production, we did the exact same thing with the show scene. Like we were getting, you know, invites to come up to Leeds early on. Obviously, they want to pay for the table and everything, and we were like, wow, this Thought Bubble looks amazing, but we're in Bristol. That is a long way to go, and then you've got the accommodation, you've got everything on top of that, and we were like, I like to eat, and I like a few beverages on the road, and so these things add up. And we were looking at it and just going, love to go to that show, literally don't know how we can make the money balance. So we went, you know what, let's not do that, let's keep our heads down, let's do the shows we can get to, focus on that, secure those fans, keep them happy, get the name going, get it working, and just keep working on the product, improving the product. And when we feel it's right, we go. And we've done that with everything, with foreign shows, with everything. We don't make the move until we know that actually we can make it. We're not going to walk home massively out of pocket, because that's a fool's approach to business, and we don't want to do that. So so we were pretty cautious. I think we probably were 7 years behind that first invite to get to the show, but it was worth it, because when we got there, the show was in such a phenomenal state, and the audience there, the crowd there, is just amazing.
Plus you had more sort of material to shift to people.
We did, and we'd obviously by that point we'd made the move, and we'd done a lot more commercial stuff, we'd done a lot more franchise material, and we'd begun that whole, you know, we'd had the whole relationship with the DFC and then the Phoenix Comic and stuff, so things had changed, you know, from how we were perceived maybe, but it was still just, you know, it's all still just tighten your belt time. You gotta make it work. But I talked to, you know, we talked to a lot of young creators and a lot of young folk coming through this business, and you know, they're always asking for, you know, advice and tips about all lots of different bits, but one that we always talk to them about is definitely the shows. Is really target them, you know, pick them. Don't go to a show the first year. Most of the time we don't go to a show the first year it starts, just because, you know, we've got other shows to go to as well, but also we want to hear what it's like. You know, sometimes you turn up to a thing and it's dead on its feet because it's the wrong area, or like Lorenzo said, there isn't the reach or whatever, and it's just a lot of time away from the desk and everything else. But if we leave a show and the next year we hear from two or three people, we had a really good time. You know, wasn't tons of people through the door, but they were really engaged and they were enthusiastic and they were buying comics and stuff. We will always give that show a go, guaranteed.
So did you say you'd done some foreign shows as well there, dude?
We've done foreign book festivals, like the comics. Again, it's the same thing. It's like the book festivals, because we were doing outside of our conversations, we started to do a lot of live shows. So we were doing like live shows on teaching creative free thinking to kids, you know, talking to them about ways to approach the page and to engage with writing and drawing, stuff like that. That became a really big thing for us and has been a really big thing for us on the side. And so we got invited out, you know, we went to Singapore and New Zealand and stuff. And so
how was Singapore? I've got some friends who do that and they really rate it as a show. Did you enjoy it? Or
it's extremely enjoyable. They are very the friendliest people probably we've encountered. Yes, that's
right. Okay.
I hope no one's listening. We did. We worked hard. Yeah. We offered them everything, and they were just like, no, that's fine. That and that and that. That's absolutely fine. And we were like, all right, so we'll just enjoy ourselves then. Singapore was great. That's a really, again, really motivated book festival. Really active group. And New Zealand was fantastic. Same sort of thing. Really passionate, like people organizing it, and that we love that stuff. And the comic show thing was the same thing. It's like, we know that's the next step for us, and obviously things have changed a bit with, you know, Lorenzo's Kickstarter and the way that that's really, you know, blown up. And so I think we're just looking now at how we take the next year's worth of business. Our American audience has grown massively, and it's where we go next, really. So it's exciting times.
You're looking to do an American festival, is that the idea? Or
yeah, we're thinking about it. We're just trying to, because frankly our books are really heavy and seriously they are, like, I mean the the stuff that we
sells, you love doing a hardcover.
I've done a few hardcovers, but it's more like the 600 page sketchbooks, of which I've got three of those. So I mean, that stuff is what people do like to get at the table. But we've got a lot of comic books and stuff as well. Because we really seriously look at the numbers when we do stuff. Same with doing planning Kickstarter and stuff. And I think any creator, any level, should always just sit and actually work it out on paper and go, right, two flights to wherever, New York, plus accommodation, plus getting our books there, plus this, plus all the food, plus that, plus the cost of the books, everything. And then we've got to make how much profit on top of that for that to be a really worthwhile trip for us. And we need how many days in New York to spend all that money as fast as we can. you add it all up and you go, like, well, actually, that's quite front loaded with costs. And so, it is. And again, the problem is because we're indie, you know, because we're not indie, we're both, we're 50-50, but a lot of our books are made by us. So we're responsible for getting them out there. We can't just say to our publisher, you know, can we have 500 copies of whatever at the show? Because that's tricky. So we're looking at that stuff. But again, like, Robin and I sort of, you know, we're both passionate about different things. I'm so passionate about, like, the online audience and what we can do with that and what we're doing with that, that it's sort of, you know, I feel like all that stuff can wait. The time will come where it'll be right and, you know, somebody will help us get out there and then we'll have a really good show and stuff. But so that is, I think that's our origin story. It almost took us long.
I was going to say, for American conventions, where are you thinking of? For an American convention, guys, where were you thinking? I would say
Mocha. There's only two on the first thing. We would either do New York or we do San Diego. I mean, there's a few others that would be good for us. I mean, New York is good. We've had friends and fellow creators who've gone out there and they've had a really good time. That's a very motivated audience who go in there. They love to buy. It is still all dominated by the same American press, but if you can go out there and you can be something unique in your own right, it's like all these things. It's like we always try and work out how we're going to position ourselves, and obviously we do have a story behind a product now and we can build on that, and we do have a catalogue behind that, but to go out there and make it work, like Lorenzo said, it's like we're going to be looking, you look at partnerships to get things done like that. And you want to be able to go out there and team up with comic shops to do some signings and do other things like that to make it all kind of cost effective. So we're only at the early stages of looking at this stuff now. But Lorenzo said, like, securing the American audience that we've really engaged now over the last, like, 2 years. Yeah. For us, that's the real thing. Feeding them exactly what they've, you know, come to expect from us, keeping that standard and that quality really high, and just consistent delivery of new engaging material. That's kind of our real main staying point right now. That's what we're trying to build. And like you said, like, everything else sort of just ends up kind of happening eventually because someone turns around and goes, we want to get you guys out here, and then we make it happen. But I think we're very pragmatic. We're not really we don't really rush in. And even though if anyone's read any of our material, you'd think we're just absolutely mental. Everything's rushed. Yeah, run over a bowl of cereal in the morning as fast as you can. Hit print. Typos be damned.
Yeah.
We are painfully pragmatic and orderly in the way that we approach the stuff we put out there, and I think it's sort of starting to pay off. So yeah.
I mean, nice. you've got an ever growing library of different titles, especially like you say, the DFC and the Phoenix. But then, I think one of the things that's really crossed the border is the sort of the tutorials. You know, you're very much, and it's not just your own work, but like for instance, today is Sunday, and you like spreading the
skill
word.
Skill up Sunday.
Yep. Every Sunday.
Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, skill up Sunday. And soon, Fundamental Friday. I haven't told you about that.
That sounds a bit political.
Oh my god.
Anyway, sorry. I interrupted you.
Today
we've been sharing other people's tips.
Yeah, because you're all about sharing the love of comics and like how to make comics and stuff. And like, certainly, you're a 10-year overnight sensation, aren't you? Really, that's what you are, because you've been in the trenches for all this time, and it's like over the past couple of years, your name has just blown up now, hasn't it?
Yeah,
Especially.
I mean, go on.
No, you carry on.
I think so. The funny thing is about
there might have been a question there. If we
do you want me to? I mean, well, I was just going to talk about. I was just going to talk about that just quickly, and then we'll get back to it. The funny thing is that I'm really into online sharing of art and ideas, and actually I have been for a long time. Although a lot of people's focus in terms of sort of comic creators and what they're doing and how well known they are and stuff is very much focused on, I guess, like Twitter and Instagram and stuff like that now. I've been sort of sharing sort of design sets and ideas and not loads of tutorials, but mostly sort of lots of sketches and ideas and tons of sort of free reference content and stuff for years on sites like DeviantArt and Tumblr and our blog, obviously, and places like that. And the thing was that actually we had grown quite a sizable audience through those sites, but that was kind of unseen because it wasn't sort of reflected in, I guess, our comic books being, you know, a bestseller in Waterstones or whatever. So
our comics weren't bestsellers.
No. our audience was, when I came to do the tutorials, it kind of felt to the people that have discovered it like it sort of came from nowhere. But actually, it was something that I've been thinking about doing for years, and was like, how do I do this? How do I do this the way I know I want to do it and fit it in? And for actually quite a few years, I'd put it off because we were making our comics and we had very little time. And I suddenly realized, like, if I don't start doing this thing, I'm never going to do it.
What inspires you to do a tutorial, though? You know, what makes, because you, obviously you've got enough on your plate doing your own comics, but what inspires you to do these tutorials to help other people make their comics?
Well, two things. The first thing is that, and it's, if you, I think you guys might have a copy of the tutorials book, I don't know, but in the intro to the book, I talk about the fact that, you know, I grew up in a little village, and Robin and I would go to secondhand bookshops and we'd buy Asterix and stuff there. And I'd also sort of buy, you know, these art books about Disney and stuff like this. And, you know, there weren't many then those days, and books on drawing and stuff. And I loved all the stuff that was out there, but I was always looking for a book about kind of how you draw sort of everything with character and personality and the different sort of ingredients that make up everything. Because I knew from looking at the background art and Disney cartoons and the characters and Asterix and stuff that there was like a billion different kind of ideas going on all at once. It's not like one way of drawing, and none of that I never found any of it covered in any book. I found it covered about characters in some books, but not in a very inspirational way. And it would sort of take you up sort of to the doorway of this, you know, they do like, here's how you draw this and here's how you draw that and here's some stuff on anatomy and here's that and here's some techniques and whatever. And I'd be like, you've taken us up like the two steps and we're now standing at the door of this enormous castle, which is How to Draw. Yeah. And you're stopping there, and you're stopping there.
And all you want to say is, where's my tutorial on pig's noses?
Where's my tutorial on pig's noses? Because we all need it. And you know, and so like, I was like, why hasn't anyone done this? And then I started thinking about doing it, and I was like, because it has to be massive, and it has to be like not big, it's massive. Mm. And as I started working on it and started doing a few tutorials just for myself to figure out the way I wanted to do it, I realized that I didn't want to lock it away in a book. And in fact, that even though I'm making it now as a book and you know, hopefully more books, that's still, you still need it all somewhere. And I just felt the internet and most of all free on the internet, because the other thing, so the one thing was I wanted this book that didn't exist, or this series of books that didn't exist. And the other thing was that, you know, when we talked earlier on about sort of starting out and stuff, but you know, when the internet began, or when it sort of first became big enough that people were really sort of starting to learn on there, everyone was sharing drawing tutorials for free. They were everywhere. You go on DeviantArt, you go on Concept Art Blog, all this stuff. There was loads of tutorials for free, and with the advent of Patreon and Gumroad and sites like that, what's happened is everybody puts a price on the thing first, and you have to pay to learn. And I think it's good that people can make money from their teaching. I think it's awesome, and I love that people that want to pay for it can pay for it. But frankly, there's millions of artists out there who can't afford it, or don't even know that there's an artist inside them, and they're not going to pay for How to Draw because they don't even know that they love drawing. And so you have to give them something that's free and pops up on their Twitter stream or their Instagram stream, where people really are on the internet now on a daily basis, rather than Googling how to draw. And you know, and it's got to be something that inspires people. And so as I started doing it, the whole thing became this thing of like, do you know what? It's not about me wanting to make these books. It's about me giving something back to drawing, which I love so much. And I know that there are so many people that, you know, they've got a bad art teacher at school, they've got parents that are super conservative and uncreative and tell them that there's no future in drawing. There's people that, you know, have been in all sorts of situations in their life, got stuck in jobs they don't like, whatever, and they don't know that they can do this thing, and they don't know that the intuit is not picking up a 200 page book that starts you with how to draw one thing and then takes you through all the stages of learning to draw. It's just looking at this little tutorial on pig's noses or something like that, and going, do you know what? I like pigs, and I kind of always wanted to draw, but I was always told I was rubbish at it, and I'm gonna have a go. And then they start and they realize they can do it because they're going in via a passion as opposed to trying to learn it in an academic way. And so once I started posting them and the messages started coming back, I mean, you should see the emails I get every day from people about what these tutorials have done for them. I mean, it's really like super emotional. I mean, it's unbelievable. Like it's not just thanks for teaching me this drawing idea. It's kind of much more sort of personal than that. The stuff people write to me about how it's sort of helped them and stuff. And once you start getting that, the responsibility of this thing gets huge, you know. And Robin's doing it now with writing, and I know he's getting the same thing. And so, you know, we're like, you know, if that Kickstarter had made our target of £1,000, I'd still do this every single week, because I'd already done it for 2 years before that, and I'd already been posting stuff for 10 years before that. So the great thing is that it's like, it's just, this is who we are. This is what we do. We love making art and stories. We've been lucky enough to do it, and now we're going to try and get as many people as we possibly can doing it. And it's all going to be free, and they're never going to need to pay. They don't need to go to art school. They don't need to pay for online courses. We're going to teach them more quicker than anybody else's, and we're going to do it all for free forever. And so that's kind of our mission statement now, and amongst doing our other books and our other stuff. And it's awesome, man, because it's just so much fun. I'm going to pass over to Bobby.
Yeah, and I just to add to that, like the way we approached this was always that we did not want to imprint style on someone's mind.
That's not okay.
Yeah, a traditional how to draw book will be showing you how to draw in a very specific way. It's the artist's way. And obviously when people look at Lorenzo's ones, they will be adopting and absorbing an element of his style. But the lessons in there have absolutely nothing to do with how he chooses to draw that detail. It is fundamentally about how you think and how you approach the creative process from the brain first. And you know, the hand is the last 5% of the process. So
it's the base level that you need.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, and it's difficult because we always wanted to be able to talk to the child who's just coming up, who's found an enthusiasm for the thing, and they just, you know, they're just looking to get some more skills. Then we want the guy who's maybe already at art school, he's maybe even on an illustration course or whatever, and he wants, you know, to adapt and to develop his style and add more, you know, skill sets to what he's already got. Then we want, you know, the professionals who are just interested in a, that's a different way of looking at it approach, you know, all of that. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Bringing the fundamentals back and allowing people to look at these ideas and get those little eureka moments. Like I had a guy the other day just say, like, the reason I really love your tutorials, both of you, is because they give me that, that's how it works kind of moment. And that's all we really wanted to do, was to pull back the rug and say, look, this is not a secret. This is not something. Yeah, these aren't rules. There's Lorenzo's approach, and it's my approach. And you know, I've been challenged on stuff, and he's been challenged on stuff we've produced, and that's absolutely right. And it's healthy, and it's as it should be, and it's definitely just our way of thinking about the page. And it's great that so many people have turned around and really engaged with the material, because we know that all it's actually doing is adding more quality stuff to the world, because it's that wave behind it, which is other people just skilling up, which
it's
is
nice,
brilliant.
It's nice to put something on the internet, you know, we everybody's sort of building their little space on the internet, and it's nice to put, if you can do what you do and what you love, but at the same time make a little bit of the internet that's a bit better, you know, make the internet a bit better, make it a bit more useful, make it a bit more creative and inclusive and all that stuff. If you can do your thing to, like, sort of just bring the internet up a little bit, where there's something else there that's always going to be there that people, you know, get a really positive benefit from. And
something
at the same time,
positive on the internet, surely not.
Yeah. We talk a lot about this, man. Like, you should see, like, I think a lot of people know this, but they don't always act on it. Like, if you put positivity out onto the internet, that is all you get back. Mm. Like, you don't get the haters. We're going to get loads of haters now I've said this, but you really don't. I mean, there's always going to be someone who says something, but I mean, like, really, like, it's remarkably easy to have a really lovely experience on the internet, where you're just putting out your work, helping people, engaging and talking to people and being kind and listening to them, and if they ask you questions, you take the time to actually give them an answer.
To interrupt there, dude, on that point you make there, is that a lot of our listeners are big fans of yours and follow what you do, and a lot of them have started doing their own. For example, Nick Prolix
is the man.
Yeah. Yeah, just want to give a little shout out. He'd have killed me if I hadn't mentioned his name.
Yeah, Nick is a diamond of a man. He is a very, very good guy. Yeah, and I mean, what Nick's done, if nobody's seen them, Nick has started a series, and he's doing a lot more now because he's starting to sort of serialize them on an online site as
Broken
well.
Broken Frontier, I think.
Broken Frontier, that's right. And so Nick does a series called Bullpen Bootcamp. And what he's doing is he's doing this great little series. They're basically mini autobiographies of comic creators, but what he's doing is he's going from the angle of he's picking one element of their career that made them different to everybody else, or that was kind of defining, and talking around it, and then talking about how you can apply it as an indie creator or as a comic creator in general. And it's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, we created this thing called Learnuary, which we've done once, and we're going to do every single year. And basically, the idea behind Learnuary is it's a whole month. It's in January. It's a whole month where every day we post brand new tutorials from us and loads of really great tutorials from around the web, as they say, from other people. But at the same time, we really encouraged people this first year when we did it. We're like, you guys, you know, everybody, it doesn't matter if you're professional or not, whatever level you are with your art, you have discovered some shortcut, some little thing that you do that probably took you weeks or months or maybe even years to discover, that you can share with somebody else and give them that
and it
doesn't erode your career, it doesn't erode what you've achieved, you know, especially if you're talking about ideas as opposed to technique, but you're just sort of sharing some little thing, even if it's like a shortcut in Photoshop or something like that, you know, whatever it is. And so we ask people to just post up tutorials, or if you don't have time to, or the inclination to make a tutorial, just a little tip or a little video of your process or whatever. And man, we got so many people involved in doing that, and it's absolutely amazing. And we're going to do the same again this year, and we're going to try and push more sort of pros as well to get involved, because I think it's important that you see all ends of the scale. And like, but yeah, and now, you know, Nick's a good example. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think that, you know, he would be the first to say that that sort of tutorial series is now taking him in directions that he had not even thought about going in, because the sharing and the encouragement and the appreciation from people of what he was doing and the love of the product he's making is making him go, wow, this is another like string in the bow of what I do, and it feeds back into it. But at the same time, it's a really exciting sort of thing. And I know Bobby's getting that with his writing. You know, we talked about like doing writing tutorials, didn't we? Because there's so much stuff about how to write out there, and I was like, but there's no one doing it like this, and that's why we should do it like this, because the person that's going to be engaged by this format, you know,
it's gonna love it. So we talked about it all. We talked about maybe doing one together, and then we realized that actually Lorenzo's art was working so well on its own that it wouldn't actually make sense for me to come on board.
We're gonna do a how to
make comics one, and we're like, hang on a minute, it's not gonna work, because there's, you know, we're going to get the same problem. It's a really perfect size space that we occupy with that, you know, social media perfect square that we're using, that if we start cluttering it, it's not going to work. Like, instead of messing up the message, we'll split it up and I'll go do the writing thing separately. It took me a long time to work out how to do it for the writing side of things. Like,
yeah, you because you just started those, haven't you? How many of those have you done?
Yeah, so I started beginning of January. I started with Learnuary, and so I think I'm doing 46 today at the moment working on. So, so it's come, you know, it comes on and it comes up fast. And it was the same thing, like trying to work out, you know, before Lorenzo's Kickstarter come off, we kind of had this idea. We knew what the scheme was going to be. Obviously, we didn't know what was about to happen with that, but... Yeah. The best thing is that we were always thinking these two things we can talk about. We can talk about in a really unique way, but it's how to make it work for the person who's only got 5 minutes. You know, like, how do you drop in on a writing tutorial without having to kill someone with the words on the page? Like, that was always the problem to begin with. And it took me a long time to work out how to really to visualize it. And then, you know, you have those little eureka moments, and then you find your way in and it starts to go. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I've been lettering our comics for so long as well that I had a good understanding of how to make those graphics readable and how to make text like engaging. So I definitely had an idea, but actually the laying up of them, my God, it takes me ages.
Yeah, it does take ages.
It takes a long time. Like, it is that thing of we. It's not that we're making it look easy, but we have made a lot of these, and you do get quicker. But it's still every time we sit down and we're like, okay, what are we?
Different every time.
Every time it's different. Different approach.
I encourage everyone to make tutorials.
Make them. Teach the world to sing.
But
outside the box as well, like what we really imagined early on, and I mean, we might get there, is that, you know, you'd get cameramen basically doing a quick tutorial on how to select the best lens if you're shooting in the desert and in the sandstorm, how do you protect, you know, it's all those kind of things that we imagine it can expand to. Every facet of art, we imagine that somebody at some point, when this can gets enough traction, they can bring that little skill set and just give someone else that beautiful moment where they go, oh, that's what I've been missing, that's what I've been trying to do.
And it's the variety of them that I love. I mean, like, there's one of my favorites is how to incorporate a logo into artwork and stuff, and I'm like, no one covers that. But obviously, being a graphic design nerd, I was like, oh, I got to read this.
Go on, sorry.
But you know, and it's also like pouring liquid. It's the little factors that you don't think about, which are really, they're the secret ingredients, aren't they? They're almost the important ingredients to making a comic. You know.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, so that 100%. And this, and it's, and I have to be not brave, because we've got enough people looking at these now that they always get a good few eyeballs on them. But I have to be like, I pick subjects based on what I want to talk about. And so sometimes I'm like, there's probably only two other people in the world that want to know how to draw cushions. But, you know, I really want to talk about how to draw cushions. So I'm just going to do it. And the great thing is that, like, some of these lessons people will never need. Some of these lessons people will need once in their whole career, but they'll need it, and it's not out there from anybody else. Yeah. And I don't know why. Well, I do know why, because as I do it, I think, is this mad? Yeah. Is this crazy? Yeah. Like, this is so big. But I think, like, once you've done it and it's out there, the beauty is you don't have to do it again. Like, yeah. That's out there forever, forever. You want to draw pouring liquid? Like, there's two little JPEGs, yeah. Teaches you pretty much everything you need to know up to a degree. And then, you know, that's it. And so it, for me, it's sort of like I have this massive list and I just love ticking them off and going, like, right, I've done that.
I mean, you thought to yourself, I really want to do 2 pages on squirrels.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I was like, I want to do squirrels. That's not the weird. I mean, stuff like newspapers and stuff like that. But then
how many of them have been suggested by people? What percentage would you say?
Of the ones I've done?
The ones you've done, what percentage would you say?
Not that many. Probably maybe 15%. Right. Because I get a lot of suggestions, but I think up like 4 or 5 a day.
Do you get like really dodgy suggestions?
No, I don't get. No, I don't get any. Dodgy.
Oh no!
Like I said,
have you not been getting my emails?
What's no, well, probably not. I don't know. I do get quite a lot of emails, so yeah. I probably just put you on the mailing list and forgot about that. I don't do that. I don't do that. What's the new thing? The DM, whatever it is, the new email listing. I don't do that. Anyway, okay. But yeah, like it's.
Oh, yeah.
we get great requests, because we get requests that I wouldn't think of, you know. So I'm trying to think of one that was a request that people really responded to. I mean, I did mountains recently, but I was going to get to it. But that one was requested a lot, and then did really well, because, you know, sometimes the stuff that isn't like the focus of a piece of art, yeah. But actually crops up in a lot of art and comics and pictures and stuff. People are like so desperate to just go, I just want to do this thing once. I keep having to tackle it. I keep coming across the same problem. I don't know how to draw a mountain in the distance that feels like it's got depth, but feels like that depth is flattened, is like more like a bas relief than it is like a real mountain in 3D space. And they don't, I think a lot of people don't realize that I think a lot of the time when people can't draw things, it's because they don't realize what the problem is. It's not that they can't draw it. They can draw it, but they're drawing it in the way that they're drawing a horse in the way they draw a car, and you can't draw a horse the same as you draw a car. You have to think of a whole load of different ideas when you're drawing a horse, and that sounds obvious.
No wheels.
Yes. And that's why I do the drawing ones and he doesn't.
I was waiting for that one.
But I mean, and that sounds silly, you know, car and horse, but the point is that like I'm not talking about what they're made of. I'm talking about the personality of them and the stance and how we sort of think about them in context and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, a car is a static thing. Even if the wheels are going round, it's still pretty static, isn't it, Burke? A horse is something.
I don't agree with that at all.
All right.
No, I don't think part of why I think I can spin these tutorials out is that I don't think anything's static. Okay. You know, I see everything as having life in it. And if you, I think when you draw stuff and think, well, a character is alive and everything else is inanimate, that's when you get that really bland sort of artwork with beautiful characters full of life running around just another kind of cookie cutter sort of city. And it's when you think about, because the life in things isn't the fact that the car can come to life. It's about the life that we project onto it when we think about what a car is, right? What a car represents, what it is. And our job as artists is to not make the car look like Benny the Cab from Roger Rabbit, but to give it, you know, to give it.
But to give
it personality. In the stance and the style and the way and the ratio of the wheels to the vehicle and the way the character sits and all this stuff. And it's the same with a toaster and it's the same with a chair and it's the same with a building. Like, there's personality, and depending on your style, you're going to want to show less of that personality, maybe just a little tiny bit of it. You think about a computer game like Uncharted, like it seems very realistic, but when you look at it, it's all styled, like that world is starting. You feel the difference between that and Assassin's Creed. Like, you feel that difference, even though it's very, very, very subtle. And so that's what I'm talking about. It's like capturing those little things. But yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can go to the point of like, well, a car's a car and a horse moves and it has all this life. But you know, you can draw a cushion and you can draw, you know, a wooden box next to each other. And those two things are totally different personality. Yeah. And you can capture it in a number of ways. And what I'm trying to do is to just sort of suggest to people, like, hey, well, think about this and think about this and think about why what this looks like and how this is like this, and this, and then here's a load of examples of how these things can look and why they're interesting to
and
me,
I think,
you know?
That's an important distinction to the books that you guys are doing with the drawing and like the writing and stuff. We've seen, you know, the tutorial books that you may have seen in the background, well, in the past, have been, this is how you draw, this is how you do this. Whereas your title is very specifically how to think when you draw. You're not telling someone, this is how you do it. You're telling people to think about what they're drawing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, the emphasis is on people. Everyone's, like you said earlier, everyone's got their style. Just think about the details that will really bring their style to life. And I think that's why...
Yeah, and it's a number
As a non-artist, what you're saying is it's not technical drawing. It's personality. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He's gone absolutely out of his way from the beginning.
Way to sum it up is, if you go through most how to draw books, you have to sit there with a pencil and a piece of paper to work through the lessons, and at the end of it, you've learnt to draw. But you can just read my tutorials, you can read the book, you don't have to draw, and you learn it, and then when you come to draw, like 2 months later, you're sitting down to draw a tree and you're like, hey, you know, he said that if I draw my tree roots and I think of like a snake eating boiled eggs and I put those lumps in the roots, it shows where the tree's like blistered out, where there's been a branch or something, and it feels real. But all you need to remember is like the snake full of boiled eggs and this lumpy thing, and that looks like an amazing tree root. And so it's like you learn it by the pictures that the sort of ideas are painting in your head, as opposed to having to sit there with a pencil and paper. And I think that's why people respond to it, because they know that they can just read it and they don't have to be sitting there drawing. Then they just read it, and even if only one little idea sticks from either of ours, that's worth reading for. Oh, yeah. And that's worth us doing it for, isn't it?
Like, yeah, we make a point of thinking, all right, well, we want to have maybe you're going to have three key take-homes per tutorial, something like that. Yeah. So you haven't got much room for more than that, and then around that you'll have other, you know, good bits of advice and stuff like that. But with that in mind, those three have to be absolutely solid gold.
Snake and
eggs! Kelvin and Hobbes! And it has to be that it's that simple, that one thing will lodge, and then if that thing lodges and we get it in there, we know you'll come back and read it again, because you'll be like, well, that was good, what else did he say? I'm sure he said something else that's worth listening to. And they're in there, and they're just nuggets. And like I say, you won't necessarily agree. You might go, well, I don't want to do that, because I'm going to put personality into my pictures this way. But there will be something that will just open up that little magic box that shows you the possibilities of where you can try something new the next time you sit down to draw or to write, and hopefully just keep people, you know, excited and inspired in their own work. And that's kind of really what we want to do. It's just how give you a weekly dose of enthusiasm for your own projects.
Yeah, and I definitely think these obviously tutorial books are going to be hugely important going forward, especially in the UK scene, all the young kids that want to make comics and stuff, especially when you start putting out the writing ones as well, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we have a publishing schedule, and we're thinking about all these things. And I mean, for us, it's always free resource online forever.
Yeah,
I mean, this will never change. We've talked about this now. Like, it wouldn't even matter if a publisher came along tomorrow and said, look, guys, I can see where this is going to go. You know, we're going to write you a blank check because we want to get this in every territory in the world. Bam, 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 bam. The first thing that we would say is, you will not be removing this from online. This is that's never coming down. There's no amount of money we could be paid for. This will be a permanent online encyclopedic resource.
So that's the legacy. The books are going to go and be lost and be gone, and will be dead. Yeah. 100 years time, there'll still be a kid clicking on the internet going, I wonder how you
think there's going to be the internet in 100 years time?
You think there's going to be kids in 100 years time?
People, but no, they'll be using squirrels. I don't know.
Maybe the books will last longer. Then.
I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work. But yeah, that's, you know, for us, that is the thing. And it is about legacy. And sometimes when people talk about legacy, it's like they feel that you are talking about a marker of success. For us, it's never been that. It's not that. It's about genuinely is the footprint that you leave behind that will enable everybody who comes after you
to move on. Legacy is what change did you make by coming this way. Like, it's what did you do? And it's once you start doing something that feels worthwhile and it's a massive job, then I think you stick at it.
Yeah,
definitely. Cool. Yeah.
So you're currently, obviously...
That's what we think anyway about creativity and books. But if you do want to know when the next Kickstarter will be available, you can always get in touch with us and we'll stick you on a list. Nice one. I will still take the £5 from your pocket. I nearly went into Michael Caine then. Yeah. I went very close to being Michael
Caine. Don't go into him. He don't like it.
So, obviously, the Kickstarter was a little bit successful. Obviously, far more than you thought it was going to be.
Audience, can I get a kaboom?
Look, don't ask me to do any more editing than I have to do on a weekly basis, because that'd just be a nightmare. You obviously have to fulfill an awful lot of books now. Was that... you don't go into anything without thinking about it, but were you sort of unprepared for how popular this thing was going to be?
How do I say this without sounding like I thought it was going to be massive? Here's the way I thought about it. The way I thought about anything, I was like, it might go big. I thought it might go big. The last one the Stransky one went bigger than I thought it would by a long way.
Yeah.
And I was like, that really surprised me because no one... So here was the market. No one was asking for me to make... most people won't know about what it is, but I did this art book called The Art of Stransky, which is just this sort of love letter to a sort of fictional long animated film. No explanation what it is, what it's about, who drew it, nothing. Just this book that I've been doing pages for. Nobody had ever asked me for a book of that stuff. And... you know, I did it, and it did like 40 grand on Kickstarter, and I was like, right. So that was quite surprising, and I was ready for it because I'd done another Kickstarter before, and I sort of, you know, it was sort of four times what I'd done before, which was kind of manageable. But then everybody started asking for the tutorials book like every day, and so I thought, well, if some of these people are genuine, there's going to be a few sales here. And so I just tried to be really responsible with what I was doing. And so what I did was I didn't plan in any way other than to just give it more lead time to fulfill. So before I'd given myself 4 months, and this time I gave myself 6 months, and I thought it can't go bigger than that. And it hasn't, you know, we're fulfilling it like no problem at all at the moment, and we're smashing through books.
So
and,
is it going to be a case of like everyone that pledged to it will get it before you're at a convention, for instance?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So things I hate about other Kickstarters. Here's my top thing I hate about other Kickstarters is somebody kickstarts a book. They haven't sent out all their rewards yet. People have kickstarted this thing. They've paid for it. They've supported the person. They've believed in the person. And then the person goes to a show and starts selling that book before they've sent it out.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
This is the greatest thing you can do. I'm talking to those creators out there doing this now. This is the worst thing you can do for Kickstarter, for supporters of art, and for your own sleep. Don't do this, right? Do not do this. That is the thing I hate more than anything else, because it gives everything a bad name and it's crummy and it just makes you look desperate for sales. Like, just get the book done. You've got the rest of your life to sell it at shows.
We've said the same thing on the Facebook page this week, dude. It was a big conversational point.
Yeah.
And you're making the point that nearly every sensible person on that thread said is you've got to send it out first. You've got to give it to the people who put that effort in. Yeah.
So we haven't made it. Basically, like, there are some shows towards the end of the year that we'd like to have this book at, that we know we could probably sell quite a lot of copies of this book at. But if we haven't sent it out to everybody by the time that show comes around, we're not going to have the book set. It's as simple as that. And we'd rather...
Which is why I'm packing as we do this interview.
We'd rather leave that money, well, not on the table, unfortunately. It's going to be nowhere near our table, is it? You know, we'd rather not have that money. You know, and there's a lot of things. I mean, you know, this book, we haven't sort of said this openly really anywhere, but this book is not available. Like, you can't get the book. If you didn't back the Kickstarter, you can't get the book. We're doing another Kickstarter next year. You might have another chance to get it then, but it's not going on Amazon. It's not like this. This series is all about the free. And at the moment, the book is, that was a one chance. If you're a core fan and you followed us, you will have seen it and got it. And if you missed out on it, then you've got to wait. And so, like, you know, because it's all about the free, and it's all about doing the right thing by those Kickstarter backers who came out in such big numbers. And it's not even just the backers, like the amount of people that shared it that couldn't afford to buy a book. They were like, oh, I haven't really got money for this. I can't really afford to buy art books, but I'm going to tell my followers about it. You know, that's huge. That's huge. Like, nobody had to do that. Nobody had to take the time out of their day to talk about our product. That was so kind of everyone. And so we're like, no, we pay these people back now by doing this the right way, which is you fulfill it. And until everybody's got, well, until everyone that's given you their address has got their book, you don't sell it to anyone else. So that is our sort of model, because that's the right way to do it, I think.
Well, you just made a lot of friends with our listeners.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, I think this whole industry, I'm going to pass over to Bobby because he's got something to say, but though he's got a smirk on his face, so it might be a throwaway comment. this whole industry, people, I think art takes such a long time to do, writing takes such a long time to do, that then you're very hungry to make money out of it. But like, the long game is the long game is everything. Like, the long game is the difference between us quitting at 5 years because we tried to sell our books every way we could and not made enough money, and us getting to a point where after 10 years, 15 years, we suddenly do $250,000 in 24 days, you know. And that's the difference. Like, that's because we waited and we were kind and we looked after people. We hopefully gave them something we wanted, and we never put the sales before what we were trying to do for people. And so I think, like, that you got to then reflect that in everything. You know, I think your Kickstarter community, if you're independent like we are, and, you know, in a way, that's the most important social network. Like, what happens after the campaign is the most important part of the whole process.
Yeah.
What were you going to say? Okay. Were you going
to
say something so flippant?
No, not at all. All I was going to say was, once we have fulfilled the campaign and those books are out there, we are going to sell to every person on the planet. No, I'm only joking. No. Oh, you're right. It was flippant. It was completely flippant. But Lorenzo's absolutely right. You know, the way we got into this purely, it was passion that drove us. We genuinely felt that there was an opportunity for us to make comic books and make, you know, bring these products to the market and bring something that had been missed from the market. Like, everything we did, from Malcolm Magic through, you know, the Monkey Nuts books, through the Long Gone Dawn, the Von Dugan puzzle series, everything that we did, there was a hole. And it was a hole that we were just looking to fill. No one else was asking for that hole to be filled, but we were looking.
Right, you're playing to us.
Yeah, be careful what you say.
I'm not going to say filling holes. Yeah. No, I wasn't drawing attention to it. You just made it non-PG by drawing attention. Lorenzo doesn't understand the jokes. He doesn't understand how a good joke plays out. Anyway, that's why I write. But we, you know, we were just making those products for ourselves, and the audience kind of, you know, came along after us. But we were never in it for that kind of cash grab. We were never in it imagining that we were going to have a title that was going to blow up into this, you know, monstrous thing. And
I mean, I was offered. I'll say it from the back of the studio, so it sounds like it's casual. You know, I had two or three publishers asked to publish this book before I made it into a Kickstarter, and I turned them all down because I knew they wouldn't do it right. I knew they wouldn't. They didn't understand what we were doing with it. And so sometimes you have to be really brave with what you're doing if you're putting your career on the line sometimes and your income on the line, and you have to, like, listen to that little thing in your gut. And it's not cockiness. It's just, like, this is the right way to do this thing. It's not necessarily the easiest way to do it, but it feels like the right way to do it. And so, you know, sometimes, again, like in your career as an indie creator, you get offered a lot of things all of a sudden. You know, as you start to get a slightly higher profile, people offer you all sorts of work, and you can get drawn away from what you really love and what you really wanted to put out in the world. And you just have to sometimes take a big risk, and it's fun.
Yeah.
That's what I've got to say from the fans.
Well, I mean, I think we could, we got to have you back on to talk about your other work in the future.
Yeah.
Feel free.
We have only sort of scraped the top of the iceberg, I think, with the Overington app. And as you can see,
are you
folks,
very politely saying that we... You're taking the skin off the chicken, and underneath the rich meat will have to wait. Or be dropped in the street as a carcass for stray cats to prey upon. Because,
well, you are the richest of meats.
With the other meats.
Yeah.
Well, we would be delighted to come back. Like I said, you know, when it comes to talking about this, the business and the work and the products, we love doing this because this is what drives us and it's what's always been the passion.
We're going to see you at a couple of conventions later
in
the year.
Where are we going to find you?
Okay, so next convention up will be Gloucester.
Little Gloucester
oh, we're doing that. Beginning of July. We will see you there.
Oh, no, sorry. I'm thinking of the... I don't think we're at that one, Vince. Are we? The True Believers Summer Variant.
True Believers Summer Variant. That is where we'll be. Yeah, that's the one, isn't it? Yeah. So, yeah, we'll be there. We'll be the two who look like us. And then I think that's nothing till September when it kicks off.
Thought Bubble Lakes Nottingham.
And nice. Yeah, something else. Yeah.
Nice. I shall be at them all, my friend. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yay!
Yeah.
And I'm also I'm hosting a panel at the True Believers Summer Variant that has Lorenzo on it. So I can physically hold you in my arms.
That could be the first comic panel Lorenzo has ever been on.
No, really?
Really?
We want just one, or we refuse to both leave.
He palms it off on me.
They wanted, well, they didn't ask me that. I said, have either of us who would you like? And they went, oh, go on then. We'll have the stupid one.
We'll have a hot draw.
That's what they said to me when I did that panel with you, Robin. Yeah.
So true. It's so.
Lorenzo, I'll be gentle with you. Don't worry.
Oh, thank you. I would appreciate that.
Yeah. And for the...
Don't ask me to do any live drawing. That's the least
bit. Paint me like one of your French girls.
Yeah. No, drawing is Lorenzo. Yeah.
So, where can
our lovely listeners... get a Titanic quote?
Yeah. I'm full of them. Yeah. Now, where can our lovely listeners find you online and these wonderful tutorials?
Okay, so if you want to find us, you can just put the Etherington Brothers into Google. You can, if you really want, just put Comic Making Brothers into Google, which will find us at the top. Not necessarily our site, but you'll find mention of us. And if you want to find our tutorials, just put How to Think When You Draw into Google, and you will find a lot of stuff. If you like Pinterest, you'll find over 500 boards, not pins, boards collecting those tutorials together. So there's absolutely tons and tons of people sharing it and putting it out there. And just put Etherington Brothers in. You'll find our old tosh.
We're not going to make it easy for you because you didn't make it easy for us.
No, that's right. The internet should be an element of discovery these days, I say.
Oh, well, you know.
Got to fight for it.
Here's a little business nugget. I've got to close it. If you've got just if you've got any creators listening who would like a very interesting tip that I found through some experimentation, I have some big sketchbooks which I sell online and through Lulu. And I used to, when I post up some of my sketches, this was years ago, I'd post a link saying, hey, if you want 600 pages of these suckers, you can go right here and get them. Here's the link, blah, blah, blah. And I suddenly thought, I'm going to try something one day. I'm just going to mention the sketchbooks on the image, on the JPEG, just put a little image of them, make no mention of it in the text, no links, nothing on our blog really talking about how to get these sketchbooks. Sales went up by an amount of five, not as in five books, five times, like through the roof, because people, I think, like as I do, I love to, if I find an artist and I'm like, I wonder if he's done anything. Oh, he did a book and it's only in French and there's only one copy of it. And I'll buy that. It's really exciting. I've discovered it. I found it. It's like going to a shop and finding like an absolute bargain. Like,
It's like the band that nobody's heard about, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a bit like that. If you make it too easy for everybody, they'll do it whenever. And it's just a little thing I found. It's like, and again, the beauty is you don't then have to be all pushy on sales, which I hate being. I'd rather just go, this is here, by the way, if you want it. And if not, don't worry.
Well, that's what you got your brother for, to be pushy.
That's what he does. Well, he's not that pretty. He's got a very casual look on his face at the moment. He has had half a beer, which is nothing really, I suppose. But he's fine. So we are in a very hot room, though.
Why are you coming? Kevin Hobbs!
So that was just a little bit from us saying where to find us. Like, you know, you don't always have to give everybody a link to everything, and I think people quite like discovering stuff for themselves a bit, which is why we've made an absolutely untraceable series of 200 tutorials. Collecting all 200 is virtually impossible because they're not numbered online, so it's really tricky to find.
Amazing.
But anyway, so that is that's all I've got to say about that. But anyway, thank you for having us on the show.
No, it's been brilliant, guys. Yeah,
it's a pleasure.
And let's just call it part one.
Part one.
Issue one of the Etheringtons.
To be continued. Whew. What can you say about that?
What happened there?
Bloody hell. Yeah. That is
nice. A lot of energy.
An epic. Yeah.
We must get them on more because I didn't actually have to ask them any questions.
We always knew that they were going to be good.
We knew it was going to be like that. Yeah, it's good though.
They love comics and they love making comics. And like I say, we've only just... It's just the tip of the iceberg, so we're definitely going to have them back.
Yep.
And some fascinating bits of tips and info there. So we hope you enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Now we're on the final bit of the show. Oh, go on, Dan.
I was going to say, give a shout out to our awesome comics crew. We had a thread going in the week like about getting burnt by Kickstarter campaigns. And one of the big ones got mentioned a couple of times was they mentioned is books being made and then there are someone's at a convention flogging the books and they haven't sent out the ones that have been backed. So Joe Bloggs turns up to a convention having backed a book and not received it. And then there's that book sitting at the table.
And to have a creator come on and sort of like just call that out and just sort of say
I mean, I've backed something and I've been aware that there's been a signing and then I've gone in my comic shop and it's for sale on the shelf in there signed, and then I've gone in a bookshop on the South Bank and it's in there and it's taken another like year for it to get to me. And I occasionally I think people, there's some double printing shenanigans going on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're selling the stock that you've paid for print and then they're getting printed later on, you know. I think there's a bit of that going on sometimes.
Very cheeky.
I think those people should be very careful because like those names get bandied around.
Yeah.
And people won't fucking back you again.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about the one where the lady in question had now got an account that just has deleted written next to her name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because she didn't send out the books and just... Because apparently Kickstarter won't let you delete the account until you've sent out your books. And so she just put brackets deleted next to her name.
Okay. Yeah,
it's incredible.
Oh, dear. But at least there's a few people out there doing it the right way.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. I think there was maybe 3 or 4 years ago, there was a lot of people who were clearly just chances and putting up Kickstarters without really thinking it through.
Yeah.
And not following. I mean, I used to see Kickstarters that were just concept sketches of characters that would be in a story and stuff like that. You know, and now it's like pretty much most books are nearly done at least, aren't they?
Yeah.
Before they're launching a Kickstarter, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But from one batch of excitement to another, do we have any shout outs?
Yeah, speaking of Kickstarters, and a Kickstarter that you can depend upon is The Human Beings. Issue 6 has just launched while we've been on the show because I've backed it. So I backed it while it's really been going. So there's that. And also, the guy I'm going to review in a second, Jens K. Stive, has got Dunce issue 4 on Kickstarter. So go and back that as well. That's another good one.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Just a couple of quick shout outs for me. Firstly, thanks to everyone who said happy birthday on the 18th. It was lovely. Made my day. That's me being a softie. And just a big shout out to Ian Matthews, the writer of Razorhawk, who chilled out with me and we just talked comics all day at the weekend. You know, great bloke. And it was just, you know, when you...
Did he bring chocolate with him?
He didn't bring chocolate this time.
What's wrong with him?
I know, but he doesn't... It's damn good chocolate.
That was at one point, that was the only thing we had to eat at Cardiff, wasn't it? Do you remember? Because we were so busy.
Yeah.
We only had some chocolate in the shape of thought bubbles.
Yeah.
And I wrote him up as being a chocolate gangster, and he said, "I quite like that."
He's also like one of us because he's a huge RoboCop fan, and he's doing a RoboCop commission piece, which is quite astonishing.
The
jam piece is amazing. Yeah, so just a shout out to Ian. Anyway, do we have any comics? Let's finish strong. Let's recommend something, shall we? Who wants to go first?
Should I go first?
Yeah, go on.
Well, I jumped in and read quite a few titles on Comic House this week on my commute. But one, I mentioned it last week and I picked it off the shelf during the week. And I've been working my way through it, is the Comics in Sequential Art by Will Eisner.
Oh, nice. Good man.
Yeah, real interesting book. I mean, when I first kind of got this years and years ago, I was kind of like eating it up like it was the gospel. But I've gone over it again. And so some things I agree with and some things I don't. There's definitely one panel that stuck out where a guy's getting shot in the back. And he's like, ah, I've been shot in the back. And Will Eisner says, look, if you're showing this in the panel, you as the artist can make the choice to get rid of the dialogue. The dialogue's not needed.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that won't fly all the time, but I would certainly suggest that if you're lettering a book and it's like that, you don't need this in it. It's like,
yeah, that sticks out a bit for me. I've got to tell you that bit of dialogue. It would definitely, in most comics, it would stick out for me.
I used to see. I mean, usually quite a lot in the, like, you know, the '80s. You know, sort of like the battle. You know, all of those sort of comics.
Yeah.
Some of those were very descriptive.
Yeah,
in their scripts, weren't they?
There's a lot of exposition in those, wasn't there? You know, because of the shortness of the stories, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
I mean, there's times when I've added stuff because, like, the art's come out a little unclear, which isn't the best. But sometimes you get more. That's the shit you got to do. But one thing that took away from me, there's a scene where a character goes into a room and the tap's dripping, and it sort of sets a tempo of the way time's being recorded. And in an earlier issue of Vanguard, there's a bit where a guy comes out and starts shooting at these guys, and a cigarette drops. And as he's going through this kind of these motions, the cigarette drops down the side of the panel and hits on the bottom one. And that was directly like inspired by Will Eisner. I was like,
nice.
Did you remember it at the time? I was like, yeah, that's how I'm going to do that. And it was kind of that from like a dripping tap. I thought, how can I measure how quickly he's doing this? And it was that little trick. So
See how we go back to the classics. We did it last week. We talked about a lot of classic creators, didn't we? A lot of classic artists. And sometimes you need to look at them, don't you, to learn?
Yeah.
I think you really do. Yeah.
Well, those foundations are so strong.
Yeah.
On a lot of them, just absolutely rock solid foundations. And if they're not in place, you can draw cool looking characters as much as you like, but your comic's not really going to cut it, in my opinion.
Nice.
I love the way you said that. You've got to make that almost a catchphrase, I think.
I need to get my hands on this book. I haven't read that book. I need to get my hands on that.
Oh, yeah. Do that one. That and Understanding Comics has still remained the two ones, don't they?
I'll go next. Just a quick one. It was a book I got on my birthday, and I've been wanting to read for a little bit. Now, you'll probably be able to guess what it is if I said the creative team were responsible for books like Criminal, Fatale, and The Fade Out.
Oh, which one did you get? Kill or Be Killed.
Kill or Be Killed, Volume 1.
Yeah,
I've been interested in this book for quite some time. But as always, when I go to look on Comixology, it's probably on about issue 9 or 10 or whatever, and I'm like, well, I always want to start at the beginning. The image thing of, like, you know, the cheap drug to get you hooked.
Yeah.
And Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips, and Elizabeth Breitweiser. Now, is Breitweiser the letterer?
Colorist.
And
I'm not sure if he letters it.
Because this is the. I mean, obviously, I know Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips are more au fait with their work, you know, as such. But
she colours a lot of their work. She colours a lot of these series, doesn't she?
Yeah. But I think one of the things I notice is when you open up this book, it just has their names and has absolutely no sort of reference to what they do. Now, obviously, if you probably follow this creative team through all their other books, and they have worked together a lot. But if Kill or Be Killed is the first time you read one of their books, I did think that was kind of odd that not even a slight mention that Ed Brubaker was the writer. Do you know what I mean? I think it was a tiny thing. It was just a tiny design thing.
Yeah, but, no, I get you sometimes around that. Yeah.
Yeah. But it did not take me out of the book. This is an absolutely awesome story that I went into it I purposely tried to avoid as much as I could about, like, spoilers and stuff. I knew it was a vigilante series. Have both of you guys read any of this?
Yeah, I've read the first trade. I own the second trade, but I haven't read it yet. But the second trade, but as I understand it, it's finished now, isn't it? Or it's about to?
It could be. It seems like the story. Yeah. From what I can tell, the story has a finite life. Yeah,
I read them in trades, and I sometimes kick myself because they have a lot of really interesting back matter that isn't reproduced in the trades, and they have essays and like guest writers and, you know, sketches and a lot of stuff in the single issues, apparently.
And they've got some great sort of cliffhanger, the way that sort of issues end, you know, because because this book, you know, it has a 2-page break, you know, just plain cover. So you do get the break. It's not like it's flowing on in one story. So, you know, I was quite appreciative to how the story sort of has these cliffhangers. But for those who don't know, it's about Dylan, who's just an average depressed grad student, until a failed suicide attempt changes everything he knows and propels him, against his will, into a life of vigilante justice. I will say, I think you should read this, Dan. I think.
I know
you're a fan of vigilantes.
Hell yeah.
What with you, your part-time job being one. but this is it's a great spin on that sort of vigilante sort of world. It's not from what I've read, it's not completely over the top. It's kind of a real life guy.
It's very realistic vigilante, isn't it? It's about the nearest you're going to get to in comics.
Yes.
Of what would actually fucking happen if you became one. You know, it's almost like that, isn't it?
And it's got this kind of noir feel to it and pulpy feel, because it is like very self-narrative, isn't it? You know, it's this guy telling the story, you know, he's narrating through all of it, which is probably more like something you get in a hard-boiled detective story. That's kind of that's how the narration feels.
I mean, a lot of their stuff is 50s and 40s and stuff like that, isn't it? It's sort of Mike Hammer kind of, Mickey Spillane kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's got some beautiful pages that just sort of break it up, of Sean Phillips just doing some amazing beautiful artwork in itself. I mean, his artwork's you know what you're going to get with Sean Phillips, and it's always going to be quality, if you ask me. But he's, you know, there's this page. He's been on the show. But like the main character's talking about how he found some old sort of artwork that his dad used to do. He used to do paintings. You know, his dad was an amazing artist before he died. And he just settled into this world of doing the weird sort of 60s and 70s sort of weird porn images, you know, little science fiction sort of porn. He wanted to get out of that, but then he was so good at it that he kept doing it. That's how he made his living. And you got some beautiful sort of imagery that Sean Phillips does of that style of illustration as well. In the mix with there's brutal violence and a lot of there's not a huge world social political story being told in this. It's a very personal story. It's a very small scale. I mean, one of the big storylines in it is between the main person and the girl that he loves. It's sort of an unrequited love story, which is, it makes it sound romantic when I put it like that, but it is quite dark. And
some of us refer to it as stalking, but yeah, okay,
it's a little bit like that. But yeah, it's a great pulp tale. I'm so glad I picked up this book. It's just beautiful. I mean, the covers are always great to look at. You know, they're very visual.
I like the sort of paperback cover feel to it, you know, like trash novel. Yeah. Have you read it, like Criminal and The Fade Out? Have you read that stuff? Have you?
I haven't. I've read a bit of Criminal. Bit of Criminal. I never read The Fade Out, and I read the first volume of Fatale, which I want to read more of. But I've heard, because you love The Fade Out, don't you?
Yeah, I really liked it. Yeah, it's that's based around old Hollywood, you know, and the sort of the things that were, you know, the real nasty backstage stuff that was going on, and people had come home from the war, and you know, there were sort of brutal men, and you know, femme fatales, and it's a really interesting and complicated and thoughtful series. You know, they've really hit their stride. I mean, they're like the Claremont and Byrne. They're like that sort of perfect casting of artists and writer now, aren't they?
Yeah. When they come together, like that team comes together, you know what you're going to get, and it's going to be quality. We've managed to do this little sort of recommendation without spoiling quite a major plot point that goes through it, which is just a great twist on it, isn't it, Tony? It's a really nice twist that makes you think. You know, there are some things that make you think, is this guy completely sane?
Yeah. So, there's no real out and out heroes in their books either. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's something going on.
Yeah. They're all deeply flawed, and certainly Dylan is a character who knows he's deeply flawed. And it's interesting how that story plays out. So yeah, Kill or Be Killed, if you like a bit of vigilante violence. I want to say justice, but I'm not quite sure how just it's going to be as the book goes on. then definitely check it out. So that's my.
And I think he's at the Lakes this year. I know he lives locally to the Lakes, isn't he?
Sean Phillips.
I think so. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I've got a feeling Brubaker's coming over, but I'm not 100% sure if that's true or not. Oh. Yeah, yeah. Would be good. Yeah. Yeah, that's what you need, just to do them together. I just bring a car full of trades for them to sign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Tony, what have you got?
I've got a book that is a book by Jens K. Stive, who is a Norwegian creator, who I talked about a couple of weeks ago with the case of Dunce, issues 1 to 3 that I bought. Now, he, whilst talking about him, Alan Henderson, who was our guest then, knew of him and recommended I get a copy of a book called Cabin Fever. Now, Jens was at LCAF this weekend, and I spent quite a lot of time with him, actually, on both the days I was in there chatting to him, and he sketched in everything I bought from him, do you know what I mean, for free. It's marvellous, you know, just some marvellous little sketches. But he had a copy of Cabin Fever, and I said, I want to get that, Cabin Fever. And he said, well, this is number 105 of 100. bearing in mind, I printed this one by accident, you can have it. And I went, oh, that's very kind of you. So I also bought some other stuff. It wasn't just I was accepting free gifts from him, you know, as the corrupt reviewer that I am. But he's, it's Cabin Fever is a bit of a sort of strange title for it, because it represents the feeling of the book and not the fact that it happens in a cabin. There's no cabins in it. It's inspired by a Nick Cave song, and it's visually influenced by a book called Ink, which, if you know anything about Warwick Johnson Cadwell, you know, it's a book he did. It's got an A5, it's got a card cover stock cover to it, and the pages are thick pages. It's done with horizontal, most of the pages have got three horizontal stacked panels, as a sort of stylistic decision, and then every so often they're broken up by a bigger splash panel. It's coloured, incidentally, it's three colours, so black and white and brown. And the colouring of the brown is the coffee he was drinking whilst making it. So he's actually coloured it with the coffee from his coffee cup, which is quite cool. Yeah. He explained that to me when I was chatting to him. This is one of the couple of books, Smedley, The Story of the Worm-Shaped Man being the other one, that I literally got and then thought, right, I'll just need a bit of peace and quiet off the busy floor. I'm going to go and read them. And I read this straight away and went back and chatted to Jens about it, which is when he was telling me about the coffee. But it's actually... quite simple and quite a short story, and it starts with a crescent moon in the sky that morphs into the plops of liquid into the sea, where a fisherman who is alone on his fishing boat, a sort of stocky older guy, sort of ruddy faced guy, is pissing off his boat into the water. And as he sort of looks round, the crescent shaped moon forms into a little face and gives him a bit of a sort of eye roll, raised eyebrow look. Oh, for God's sake. Do you know, like that? Sort of, I don't need to see your knob. and then it becomes this sort of lonely story about him. And he's sitting in this boat and he's fishing and he's smoking and he's playing solitaire. And he's looking through his binoculars. And as he's looking through his binoculars, he just sees a face pop up on the horizon of the sea, with hair, and he's like, oh, what's that? You know, it's actually wordless. There's no words in this book either at all. So you get his sort of the reaction in his face. And just as the sort of bubbles float up to the surface, as he's looking through his binoculars, a tail wisps away. So you think, oh, hang on a minute. Right. Okay. So it's like a mermaid. Do you know what I mean? So he's sitting there thinking, what does that mean? And I'm not au fait with Norwegian folk tales, but I get the feeling that a mermaid is perhaps something slightly more sinister, in Norway than it is over here, because a creature appears, and it's this sort of skull-faced creature with sea anemones and stuff stuck to its skull. And I won't spoil the rest of it, but something happens, and you think, oh, okay. It's a little bit Seventh Seal-y. That's all I'm going to say. You know the movie The Seventh Seal, where he plays the devil with chess? There's a little bit of that goes on, which is nice. It's just sort of a quiet, clever... It's just really well paced. The three horizontal panels give it this sort of real sort of sedate pace that allows him to, on the turn of a page, to shift to something more dramatic, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Real. If you looked at this book, it's like it would give you a few instructions on something if you wanted to do a book of pacing like this. Really, really clever. Everything is not as it seems, though. There's a twist in the end, which is really good. Highly recommended. If you can get your hands on maybe 106 of 100, you might be all right. But I was lucky to get one of the overruns. But he is talking about reprinting it. He's also talking about redrawing some of it, which I was quite surprised about, actually, because he said he started doing it when he got back into comics again. You know, some people fall out of comics, don't they?
Yeah.
And came back in. And he thought, oh, I'll do this. And he's thinking about redrawing it. Oh, fuck knows why, because it's absolutely beautiful to me. Yeah. If you go to www.jensk.com, jensk.no or at Jensk, J-E-N-S-K, and then Stive, S-T-Y-V-E. That's his Twitter account. You can find a copy and order some stuff. He's got a Kickstarter going at the moment, as we mentioned earlier, for the new issue of Dunce. Anything Dunce-wise. I picked up a couple of his sketchbooks. Last Breath is one of them, which is about skeletons, and Dance Macabre is another one. All really good stuff. He's one of those creators who's got like a bit of a sort of wicked grin on his face. And he's nice. A really interesting guy to chat to. And he was a top bloke behind the table. You walk over, he stands up, he engages you. He has a little anecdote to tell you about each book. Yeah, really good. Really good stuff. And the other one I just wanted to give his little tiny shout out to was an image of a cover I sent you guys earlier called Blop Comics.
yeah, great. You got a fucking big laugh at me.
So, but the only reason I didn't go into it is slightly more detail is it's a bit of a historic book. I think it's from 2013 or something. But Blop Comics, the cover is a little alien in a spaceship above a planet, and on the planet is the sort of a smiling face, like the man in the moon kind of smiling face. And do you remember that bit in I don't know if anyone's seen the new series of Star Trek, where they summon the Enterprise by walking around in a circle to make the shape of like the most fucking stupid thing I've ever seen in my life. In this. They've two people have walked around in a circle, and the shape they've made is a cock and balls going into the mouth of the man in the room. So that's good. And that gives the tone of it. And it's a little anthology of all different styles, actually. The guy does really well because he's obviously very capable of as an artist. He's a guy called Alex Hain, who's an English creator.
Who was also on the table next to me at my first ever Thought Bubble. Really nice guy.
Oh, nice. Really? Yeah. Oh, nice one. Yeah really
it's
nice
the
guy.
Alien's face that sells that image.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the big eyeballs staring and the open mouth going, oh my God, what have they done there? But on the back, he's got there's an advertisement for his next issue, and it says, a shameless plug. And it's a picture of a plug with its knob out. Which I thought was quite clever. So, look out for Blop. B-L-O-P. Look out for Alex Hain. Yeah, very good. There you go. That's
fine. There you go. What a menagerie of comic goodness we had for you this week. Whew. I tell you what, I need a nap after all this. Well, I can't have one because I've got to go and edit this show. But we hope you enjoyed it, folks, and got a lot from it. If, as always, you want to get in touch with us about this show, if you want to learn more, or perhaps we just said something wrong, or if you were just offended by how much I messed up the Comic House sponsorship ad earlier,
well, then surely not.
Yeah, you know, I'm a pro. I'm a pro.
What I've said.
Watch yourself. you can email us at awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Likewise, we want letters for our comic as well.
Oh, yeah.
Issue three. Yes.
Yeah.
Our comic, which you can get at... Oh, am I just talking to myself then?
No, Dan doesn't.
No, sorry, I thought you were going to get the... it's the Awesome Comics Big Cartel store.
Yeah. We've
got issue 1 and 2 available in print and digital. Very reasonably priced.
And if you want to have your letter featured in issue 3, which is in the pipeline now, then you can send us your letter to tony.awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. He is the editor of the letters page. God help us.
Yeah.
God help us all.
Dear Ed.
I keep forgetting I'm doing that.
Yeah. Liberate tuta me. Now, if you watched Event Horizon, you'll know what that means. If you follow us on Twitter, then get your friends to follow us at The Awesome Pod, where we'll talk about God knows what, but we retweet things, we shout about the guests that are upcoming, and we also have Kickstarter call out, which I forgot to do that last week, but
on a Thursday
this week, didn't we?
Yeah. So look for that on Thursdays on at The Awesome Pod, because we'll be retweeting and shouting about a lot of cool comic Kickstarters there about. Now, if you do the Book of Faces, then go to facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast, and if you want to have a genuine talk about comics, whether it be making them or going to conventions or all kinds, then join the Facebook group Awesome Comics Talk, which is always a good read, even if you don't get involved. It's just a fascinating read. And there's no hard sell. We don't accept any sale. No. Yeah, no one's selling you anything. We just want to talk comics, so go there.
I was going to float, on Facebook, they've introduced a new thing where you can mentor people on Facebook, like in groups and stuff. Mentor people. So, like, I'm not sure if people would be up for this, but, like, someone who's kind of a little better than someone else on artwork, perhaps we could maybe talk about setting up a mentor program where someone who's not so good would get some kind of mentoring on their artwork or writing.
What should we call that? Like awesome grooming? I don't know.
That's interesting because we've got a mentoring system in my work, and I've got 100% record for it. Have I told you this? No, I've got 100% no. mentoring record because I've mentored 5 people and they've all failed.
I always said
you're an expert at something, Tony.
Yeah, it gets announced at every yearly meeting we have, and I'm quite proud of it still.
Yeah. But, do you get a little cheer? Do people
yeah, I do. Hey. No, I literally do. Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
That's brilliant.
Oh, well, maybe we'll have a discussion about not Tony's failure, but the mentoring thing on Awesome Comics Talk.
We do that most weeks.
Yeah, that's true. Thank you for listening to us, whether it was on the website awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listen to us on iTunes, subscribe and leave a nice review. It just helps get the word out and more people learn about how to make comics and great comics in general. And if you listen to us on Stitcher, Podnose, Podknife, what other networks are we on, Tony?
Pod Rhubarb Beer.
Then thank you very much. Help spread the word. And where can people find us online, etc.? Who wants to go first?
Daniel?
You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can read Vanguard at vanguardcomic.com, which the proper comic pages start today, this week on Wednesday.
Yes. Cool. The triumphant return of Vanguard.
I always do those kind of previously pages, like to kind of get people up to speed. And I'm never sure if people kind of think they're a good idea or not, but I think when you're doing a web comic and you can have a massive gap between the two, I think it helps. So,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I'm going to keep doing it. Fuck you.
Yeah, fuck everyone. Yeah.
That's why we love him.
Naysayers.
Yeah. What about you, Tony?
Ezoyes on Twitter, EZOHYZ, neverironanything.blogspot.co.uk. There's a load of LCAF. There's an LCAF report gone up, which has been really popular, actually. A lot of people read that and are very pleased. And also, next month, if you listen to Signals from the Hill, you'll hear my tightly scripted advert that all three of us acted out, which I sent sent through to Stephen Walsh today. And he messaged back saying, "That's great." I thought, "Oh, brilliant."
Oh, thank God.
it turned out about 100 times better than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
When he sent back the edited version, I was like, that's pretty good.
Yeah. With a bit of music that you added at the start. Yeah. Make it cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, gents. Yes. Maybe once that's up and running, we might put that as a secret extra in a future show.
So that'd be a good one.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, so you can find me online at Jester Diablo and follow my comic at The Red Mask from Mars.com. And thank you once again to the Etherington brothers for just bringing the Red Bull can of furious enthusiasm to this show. Yeah, which is amazing. And we look forward to meeting them face to face at future shows and having a good old conversation and picking up some of their stuff as well. So, and thank you all for listening, because it's been another great one. Now that we're back on, I think we're back on form with the regular format, aren't we?
Yeah, living the dream.
Yeah, living the dream. Yep. Hashtag thug life. Anyway, all you lovely people out there, have a brilliant week. Read loads of comics. Spread the love about comics and just enjoy life. And from Dan, Tony and myself, have a brilliant week. And as always, what do they do, Dan?
Stay awesome.
God, is Kermit in the house?
Yep. And I think someone should make a mix out of that. Put that bit of audio into a song, and we'll love you forever. Anyway, have a brilliant week, folks. See you later.
See ya.